an uneasy week. Off to Providence. On Monday, after his mom had gone to work, Bobby went upstairs to read Ted the paper. Although his eyes were actually good enough to do it himself, Ted said he had come to enjoy the sound of Bobby's voice and the luxury of being read to while he shaved. Ted stood in his little bathroom with the door open, scraping foam from his face, while Bobby tried him on various headlines from the various sections. Viet skirmishes intensify? Before breakfast, thanks, but no thanks. Carts corralled, local man arrested? First paragraph, Bobby. When police showed up at his Pond Lane residence late yesterday, John T. Anderson of Harwich told them all about his hobby, which he claims is collecting supermarket shopping carts. He was very interesting on the subject, said Officer Kirby Malloy of the Harwich PD, but we weren't entirely satisfied that he'd come by some of the carts in his collection honestly. Turns out Malloy was right with Eversharp. Of the more than 50 shopping carts in Mr. Anderson's backyard, at least 20 had been stolen from the Harwich A&P and Total Grocery. There were even a few carts from the IGA market in Stansbury. Enough, Ted said, rinsing his razor under hot water and then raising the blade to his lathered neck. Galumphing small-town humor in response to pathetic acts of compulsive larceny. I don't understand you. Mr. Anderson sounds like a man suffering from a neurosis, a mental problem, in other words. Do you think mental problems are funny? Gee, no. I feel bad for people with loose screws. I'm glad to hear you say so. I've known people whose screws were not just loose, but entirely missing. A good many such people, in fact. They are often pathetic, sometimes awe-inspiring, and occasionally terrifying, but they are not funny. Carts corralled, indeed. What else is there? Starlet killed in European road accident? Ugh, no. Yankees acquire infielder in trade with Senators? Nothing the Yankees do with the Senators interests me. Albini relishes underdog role? Yes, please read that. Ted listened closely as he painstakingly shaved his throat. Bobby himself found the story less than riveting. It wasn't about Floyd Patterson or Ingemar Johansson, after all. Sully called the Swedish heavyweight Ingi Baby, but he read it carefully nevertheless. The 12-rounder between Tommy Hurricane Haywood and Eddie Albini was scheduled for Madison Square Garden on Wednesday night of the following week. Both fighters had good records, but age was considered an important, perhaps telling factor. Haywood, 23, to Eddie Albini's 36, and a heavy favorite. The winner might get a shot at the heavyweight title in the fall, probably around the time Richard Nixon won the presidency. Bobby's mom said that was sure to happen and a good thing. Never mind that Kennedy was a Catholic. He was just too young and apt to be a hothead. In the article, Albini said he could understand why he was the underdog. He was getting up in years a little, and some folks thought he was past it because he lost by TKO to Sugar Boy Masters in his last fight. And sure, he knew that Haywood outreached him and was supposed to be mighty savvy for a younger fellow, but he'd been training hard, Albini said, skipping a lot of rope and sparring with a guy who moved and jabbed like Haywood. The article was full of words like game and determined. Albini was described as being full of grit. Bobby could tell. The writer thought Albini was going to get the stuffing knocked out of him and felt sorry for him. Hurricane Haywood hadn't been available to talk to the reporter, but his manager, a fellow named I. Kleindienst, Ted had told Bobby how to pronounce the name, said it was likely to be Eddie Albini's last fight. He had his day, but his day is over, I. Kleindienst said. If Eddie goes six, I'm going to send my boy to bed without his supper. Irving Kleindienst's a kamai, Ted said.
A what?
A fool. Ted was looking out the window toward the sound of Mrs. O'Hara's dog. Not totally blank the way he sometimes went blank, but distant.
You know him?
Bobby asked. No, Ted said. He seemed first startled by the idea, then amused. No, of him.
Sounds to me like this guy Albini is going to get creamed.
You never know. That's what makes it interesting. What do you mean? Nothing. Go to the comics, Bobby. I want Flash Gordon, and be sure to tell me what Dale Arden's wearing.
Why?
Because I think she's a real hotsy-totsy, Ted said. And Bobby burst out laughing. He couldn't help it. Sometimes Ted was a real card. A day later, on his way back from Sterling House, where he had just filled out the rest of his forms for summer baseball, Bobby came upon a carefully printed poster thumbtacked to an elm in Commonwealth Park. Please help us find Phil. Phil is our Welsh corgi. Phil is 7 years old. Phil is brown with a white bib. His eyes are bright and intelligent. The tips of his ears are black. We'll bring you a ball if you say, hurry up, Phil. Call Housatonic 5-8337 or bring to 745 Highgate Avenue, home of the Sagamore family. There was no picture of Phil. Bobby stood looking at the poster for a fair length of time. Part of him wanted to run home and tell Ted, not only about this, but about the star and crescent moon he'd seen chalked beside the hopscotch grid. Another part pointed out that there was all sorts of stuff posted in the park. He could see a sign advertising a concert in the town square, posted on another elm right across from where he was standing, and he'd be nuts to get Ted going about this. These two thoughts contended with each other until they felt like two sticks rubbing together in his brain in danger of catching on fire. I won't think about it, he told himself, stepping back from the poster, and when a voice from deep within his mind, a dangerously adult voice, protested that he was being paid to think about stuff like this, to tell about stuff like this, Bobby told the voice to just shut up. And the voice did. When he got home, his mother was sitting on the porch glider again, this time mending the sleeve of a house dress. She looked up, and Bobby saw the puffy skin beneath her eyes, the reddened lids. She had a Kleenex folded into one hand. Mom? What's wrong was how the thought finished, but finishing it would be unwise, would likely cause trouble. Bobby had had no recurrence of his brilliant insights on the day of the trip to Savin Rock, but he knew her. The way she looked at him when she was upset, the way the hand with the Kleenex in it tensed, almost becoming a fist, the way she drew in breath and sat up straighter, ready to give you a fight if you wanted to go against her. What? She asked him. Got something on your mind besides your hair? No, he said. His voice sounded awkward and oddly shy to his own ears. I was at Sterling House. The list's up for baseball. I'm a wolf again this summer. She nodded and relaxed a little. I'm sure you'll make the Lions next year. She moved her sewing basket from the glider to the porch floor, then patted the empty place. Sit down here beside me a minute, Bobby. I've got something to tell you. Bobby sat with a feeling of trepidation. She'd been crying after all, and she sounded quite grave. But it turned out not to be a big deal, at least as far as he could see. Mr. Biderman, Don, has invited me to go with him and Mr. Cushman and Mr. Dean to a seminar in Providence. It's a big chance for me. What's a seminar? A sort of conference. People get together to learn about a subject and discuss it. This one is real estate in the 60s. I was very surprised that Don would invite me. Bill Cushman and Curtis Dean, of course, I knew they'd be going. They're agents, but for Don to ask me. She trailed off for a moment, then turned to Bobby and smiled. He thought it was a genuine smile, but it went oddly with her reddened lids. I've wanted to become an agent myself for the longest time, and now this, right out of the blue, it's a big chance for me, Bobby. It could mean a big change for us. Bobby knew his mom wanted to sell real estate. She had books on the subject and read a little out of them almost every night, often underlining parts. But if it was such a big chance, why had it made her cry? Wow, that's good, he said. The Ginchiest, I hope you learn a lot. When is it? Next week. The four of us leave early Tuesday morning and get back Thursday night around 8 o'clock. All the meetings are at the Warwick Hotel, and that's where we'll be staying. Don's booked the rooms. I haven't stayed in a hotel room for 12 years, I guess. I'm a little nervous. Did nervous make you cry? Bobby wondered. Maybe so if you were a grown-up, especially a female grown-up. I want you to ask S.J. if you can stay with him Tuesday and Wednesday night. I'm sure Mrs. Sullivan, Bobby shook his head, that won't work. Why ever not? Liz bent a fierce look at him. Mrs. Sullivan has never minded you staying over before. You haven't gotten into her bad books somehow, have you? No, Mom. It's just that S.J. won a week at Camp Winnie. The sound of all those W's coming out of his mouth made him feel like smiling, but he held it in. His mother was still looking at him in that fierce way, and wasn't there a kind of panic in that look? Panic or something like it? What's Camp Winnie? What are you talking about? Bobby explained about S.J. winning the free week at Camp Winnemunaya and how Mrs. Sullivan was going to visit her sister in Wisconsin at the same time, plans which had now been finalized, big gray dog and all. Damn it, that's just my luck, his mom said. She almost never swore. Said that cursing and what she called dirty talk was the language of the ignorant. Now she made a fist and struck the arm of the glider. God damn it. She sat for a moment thinking. Bobby thought as well. His only other close friend on the street was Carol, and he doubted his mom would call Anita Gerber and ask if he could stay over there. Carol was a girl, and somehow that made a difference when it came to sleepovers. One of his mother's friends, the thing was, she didn't really have any. Except for Don Biderman, and maybe the other two that were going to the seminar in Providence. Plenty of acquaintances, people she'd say hi to if they were walking back from the supermarket or going to a Friday night movie downtown, but no one she could call up and ask to keep her 11-year-old son for a couple of nights. No relatives, either. At least none that Bobby knew of. Like people traveling on converging roads, Bobby and his mother gradually drew toward the same point. Bobby got there first, if only by a second or two. What about Ted? He asked, and then almost clapped his hand over his mouth. It actually rose out of his lap a little. His mother watched the hand settle back with a return of her old cynical half-smile, the one she wore when dispensing sayings like, you have to eat a peck of dirt before you die, and two men looked out through prison bars, one saw the mud and one saw the stars. And, of course, that all-time favorite, life's not fair. You think I don't know you call him Ted when the two of you are together, she asked. You must think I've been taking stupid pills, Bobby O. She sat and looked out at the street. A Chrysler New Yorker slid slowly past, finny, fender-skirted and highlighted with chrome. Bobby watched it go by. The man behind the wheel was elderly and white-haired and wearing a blue jacket. Bobby thought he was probably all right. Old, but not low. Maybe it'd work, Liz said at last. She spoke musingly, more to herself than to her son. Let's go talk to Brodigan and see. Following her up the stairs to the third floor, Bobby wondered how long she had known how to say Ted's name correctly. A week? A month? From the start, Dumbo, he thought. From the very first day. Bobby's initial idea was that Ted could stay in his own room on the third floor while Bobby stayed in the apartment on the first floor. They'd both keep their doors open, and if either of them needed anything, they could call. I don't believe the Kilgallens or the Proskys would enjoy you yelling up to Mr. Brodigan at 3 o'clock in the morning that you'd had a nightmare, Liz said tartly. The Kilgallens and the Proskys had the two small second-floor apartments. Liz and Bobby were friendly with neither of them. I won't have any nightmares, Bobby said, deeply humiliated to be treated like a little kid. I mean, jeepers. Keep it to yourself, his mom said tartly. They were sitting at Ted's kitchen table, the two adults smoking Bobby with a root beer in front of him. It's just not the right idea, Ted told him. You're a good kid, Bobby, responsible and level-headed, but 11's too young to be on your own, I think. Bobby found it easier to be called too young by his friend than by his mother. Also, he had to admit that it might be spooky To wake up in one of those little hours after midnight and go to the bathroom knowing he was the only person in the apartment. He could do it. He had no doubt he could do it. But yeah, it would be spooky. What about the couch? He asked. It pulls out and makes a bed, doesn't it? They had never used it that way. Bobby was sure she told him once that it did. He was right, and it solved the problem. She probably hadn't wanted Bobby in her bed, let alone Bradigan. And she really hadn't wanted Bobby up here in this hot third-floor room, that he was sure of. He figured she'd been looking so hard for a solution that she'd look right past the obvious one. So it was decided that Ted would spend Tuesday and Wednesday nights of the following week on the pull-out couch in the Garfields' living room. Bobby was excited by the prospect. He would have 2 days on his own, 3 counting Thursday, and there would be someone with him at night when things could get spooky. Not a babysitter either, but a grown-up friend. It wasn't the same as Sully John going to Camp Winnie for a week, but in a way it was. Camp Broad Street, Bobby thought and almost laughed out loud. We'll have fun, Ted said. I'll make my famous beans and Frank's casserole. He reached over and ruffled Bobby's crew cut. If you're going to have beans and Frank's, it might be wise to bring that down, his mom said, and pointed the fingers holding her cigarette at Ted's fan. Ted and Bobby laughed. Liz Garfield smiled her cynical half-smile, finished her cigarette, and put it out in Ted's ashtray. When she did, Bobby again noticed the puffiness of her eyelids. As Bobby and his mother went back down the stairs, Bobby remembered the poster he had seen in the park, the missing corgi who would bring you a ball if you said, "Hurry up, Phil." He should tell Ted about the poster. He should tell Ted about everything. But if he did that and Ted left 149, who would stay with him next week? What would happen to Camp Broad Street? 2 fellas eating Ted's famous beans and Frank's casserole for supper, maybe in front of the TV, which his mom rarely allowed, and then staying up as late as they wanted. Bobby made a promise to himself. He would tell Ted everything next Friday, after his mother was back from her conference or seminar or whatever it was. He would make a complete report, and Ted could do whatever he needed to do. He might even stick around. With this decision, Bobby's mind cleared amazingly, and when he saw an upside-down for sale card on the total grocery bulletin board 2 days later, it was for a washer-dryer set, he was able to put it out of his thoughts almost immediately. That was, nevertheless, an uneasy week for Bobby Garfield, very uneasy indeed. He saw 2 more lost pet posters, 1 downtown and 1 out on Asher Avenue, half a mile beyond the Asher Empire. The block he lived on was no longer enough. He found himself going farther and farther afield in his daily scouting trips. And Ted began to have those weird blank periods with greater frequency. They lasted longer when they came, too. Sometimes he spoke when he was in that distant state of mind, and not always in English. When he did speak in English, what he said did not always make sense. Most of the time, Bobby thought Ted was one of the sanest, smartest, neatest guys he'd ever met. When he went away, though, it was scary. At least his mom didn't know. Bobby didn't think she'd be too cool on the idea of leaving him with a guy who sometimes flipped out and started talking nonsense in English or gibberish in some other language. After one of these lapses, when Ted did nothing for almost a minute and a half but stare blankly off into space, making no response to Bobby's increasingly agitated questions, it occurred to Bobby that perhaps Ted wasn't in his own head at all, but in some other world, that he had left Earth, as surely as those people in Ring Around the Sun, who discovered they could follow the spirals on a child's top to just about anywhere. Ted had been holding a Chesterfield between his fingers when he went blank. The ash grew long and eventually dropped off onto the table. When the coal grew unnervingly close to Ted's bunchy knuckles, Bobby pulled it gently free and was putting it out in the overflowing ashtray when Ted finally came back.
"Smoking?" he asked with a frown. "Hell, Bobby, you're too young to smoke."
"It's just putting it out for you. I thought..." Bobby shrugged, suddenly shy. Ted looked at the first two fingers of his right hand, where there was a permanent yellow nicotine stain. He laughed, a short bark with absolutely no humor in it. "Thought I was going to burn myself, did you?" Bobby nodded. "What do you think about when you go off like that? Where do you go?"
"That's hard to explain," Ted replied, and then asked Bobby to read him his horoscope.
Thinking about Ted's trances was distracting. Not talking about the things Ted was paying him to look for was even more distracting. As a result, Bobby, ordinarily a pretty good hitter, struck out 4 times in an afternoon game for the Wolves at Sterling House. He also lost 4 straight battleship games to Sully at SJ's house on Friday when it rained.
"What the heck's wrong with you?" Sully asked. "That's the 3rd time you called out squares you already called out before. Also, I have to practically holler in your ear before you answer me. What's up?"
"Nothing."
That was what he said.
"Everything." That was what he felt. Carol also asked Bobby a couple of times that week if he was okay. Mrs. Gerber asked if he was off his feed. Yvonne Loving wanted to know if he had mono, then giggled until she seemed in danger of exploding. The only person who didn't notice Bobby's odd behavior was his mom. Liz Garfield was increasingly preoccupied with her trip to Providence, talking on the phone in the evenings with Mr. Biderman or one of the other two who were going. Bill Cushman was one of them. Bobby couldn't exactly remember the name of the other guy. Laying clothes out on her bed until the spread was almost covered, then shaking her head over them angrily and returning them to the closet, making an appointment to get her hair done, and then calling the lady back and asking if she could add a manicure. Bobby wasn't even sure what a manicure was. He had to ask Ted. She seemed excited by her preparations, but there was also a kind of grimness to her. She was like a soldier about to storm an enemy beach, or a paratrooper who would soon be jumping out of a plane and landing behind enemy lines. One of her evening telephone conversations seemed to be a whispered argument. Bobby had an idea it was with Mr. Biderman, but he wasn't sure. On Saturday, Bobby came into her bedroom and saw her looking at 2 new dresses. Dressy dresses. One with thin little shoulder straps and one with no straps at all, just a top like a bathing suit. The boxes they had come in lay tumbled on the floor with tissue paper foaming out of them. His mom was standing over the dresses looking down at them with an expression Bobby had never seen before. Big eyes, drawn together brows, taut white cheeks, which flared with spots of rouge. One hand was at her mouth, and he could hear bone-like clittering sounds as she bit at her nails. A cool smoldered in an ashtray on the bureau, apparently forgotten. Her big eyes shuttled back and forth between the 2 dresses. "Mom?" Bobby asked, and she jumped, literally jumped into the air. Then she whirled on him, her mouth drawn down in a grimace. "Jesus Christ," she almost snarled, "don't you knock?" "I'm sorry," he said, and began to back out of the room. His mother had never said anything about knocking before. "Mom, are you all right?" "Fine!" She spied the cigarette, grabbed it, smoked furiously. She exhaled with such force that Bobby almost expected to see smoke come from her ears as well as her nose and mouth. "I'd be finer if I could find a cocktail dress that didn't make me look like Elsie the cow. Once I was a size 6. Do you know that? Before I married your father, I was a size 6. Now look at me. Elsie the cow. Moby damn dick."
"Mom, you're not big. In fact, just lately you look..." "Get out, Bobby. Please let Mother alone. I have a headache."
That night he heard her crying again. The following day he saw her carefully packing one of the dresses into her luggage, the one with the thin straps. The other went back into its store box. "Gowns by Lucy of Bridgeport" was written across the front in elegant maroon script. On Monday night, Liz invited Ted Brodigan down to have dinner with them. Bobby loved his mother's meatloaf and usually asked for seconds, but on this occasion he had to work hard to stuff down a single piece. He was terrified that Ted would trance out and his mother would pitch a fit over it. His fear proved groundless. Ted spoke pleasantly of his childhood in New Jersey, and when Bobby's mom asked him of his job in Hartford. To Bobby, he seemed less comfortable talking about accounting than he did reminiscing about slang as a kid, but his mom didn't appear to notice. Ted did ask for a second slice of meatloaf. When the meal was over and the table cleared, Liz gave Ted a list of telephone numbers, including those of Dr. Gordon, the Sterling House Summer Rec Office, and the Warwick Hotel. "If there are any problems, I want to hear from you. Okay?" Ted nodded. "Okay. Bobby, no big worries?" She put her hand briefly on his forehead the way she used to do when he complained of feeling feverish. "Nope, we'll have a blast, won't we, Mr. Brodigan?" "Oh, call him Ted," Liz almost snapped. "If he's going to be sleeping in our living room, I guess I better call him Ted, too."
"May I?"
"Indeed you may. Let it be Ted from this moment on." He smiled. Bobby thought it was a sweet smile, open and friendly. He didn't understand how anyone could resist it. But his mother could and did. Even now, while she was returning Ted's smile, he saw the hand with the Kleenex in it tightening and loosening in its old familiar gesture of anxious displeasure. One of her absolute favorite sayings now came to Bobby's mind. "I'd trust him or her as far as I could sling a piano. And from now on, I'm Liz." She held out a hand across the table, and they shook like people meeting for the first time. Except, Bobby knew his mother's mind was already made up on the subject of Ted Brodigan. If her back hadn't been against the wall, she never would have trusted Bobby with him, not in a million years. She opened her purse and took out a plain white envelope. "There's $10 in here," she said, handing the envelope to Ted. "You boys will want to eat out at least one night, I expect. Bobby likes the Colony Diner, if that's all right with you, and you may want to take in a movie as well. I don't know what else there might be, but it's best to have a little cushion, don't you think?"
"Always better safe than sorry," Ted agreed, tucking the envelope carefully into the front pocket of his slacks. "But I don't expect we'll go through anything like $10 in 3 days, will we, Bobby?"
"Gee, no, I don't see how we could."
"Waste not, want not," Liz said. It was another of her favorites, right up there with "The Fool and His Money Soon Parted." She plucked a cigarette out of the pack on the table beside the sofa and lit it with a hand which was not quite steady.
"You boys will be fine. Probably have a better time than I will."
Looking at her ragged, bitten fingernails, Bobby thought, "That's for sure." His mom and the others were going to Providence in Mr. Biderman's car, and the next morning at 7 o'clock, Liz and Bobby Garfield stood on the porch waiting for it to show up. The air had that early hazy hush that meant the hot days of summer had arrived. From Asher Avenue came the hoot and rumble of heavy going-to-work traffic, but down here on Broad there was only the occasional passing car or delivery truck. Bobby could hear the hisha, hisha of lawn sprinklers, and from the other side of the block the endless roof, roof, roof of Bowser. Bowser sounded the same, whether it was June or January. To Bobby Garfield, Bowser seemed as changeless as God.
"You don't have to wait out here with me, you know," Liz said. She was wearing a light coat and smoking a cigarette. She had on a little more makeup than usual, but Bobby thought he could still detect shadows under her eyes. She had passed another restless night.
I don't mind. I hope it's all right leaving you with him. I wish you wouldn't worry. Ted's a good guy, Mom. She made a little humping noise. There was a twinkle of chrome from the bottom of the hill as Mr. Biderman's Mercury, not vulgar exactly, but a boat of a car all the same, turned onto their street from Commonwealth and came up the hill toward 149. There he is, there he is, his mom said, sounding nervous and excited. She bent down. Give me a little smooch, Bobby. I don't want to kiss you and smear my lipstick. Bobby put his hand on her arm and lightly kissed her cheek. He smelled her hair, the perfume she was wearing, her face powder. He would never kiss her with that same unshadowed love again. She gave him a vague little smile, not looking at him, looking instead at Mr. Biderman's boat of a Merc, which swerved gracefully across the street and pulled up at the curb in front of the house. She reached for her two suitcases. Two seemed a lot for 2 days, Bobby thought, although he supposed the fancy dress took up a good deal of space in one of them, but he already had them by the handles. Those are too heavy, Bobby. You'll trip on the steps. No, he said. I won't. She gave him a distracted look, then waved to Mr. Biderman and went toward the car, high heels clacking. Bobby followed, trying not to grimace at the weight of the suitcases. What had she put in them, clothes or bricks? He got them down to the sidewalk without having to stop and rest, at least. Mr. Biderman was out of the car by then, first putting a casual kiss on his mother's cheek, then shaking out the key that opened the trunk. How you doing, sport? How's the boy? Mr. Biderman always called Bobby sport. Lug him around back and I'll slide him in. Women always have to bring the farm, don't they? Well, you know the old saying, can't live with him, can't shoot him outside the state of Montana. He bared his teeth in a grin that made Bobby think of Jack in Lord of the Flies. Want me to take one? I've got him, Bobby said. He trudged grimly in Mr. Biderman's wake, shoulders aching, the back of his neck hot and starting to sweat. Mr. Biderman opened the trunk, plucked the suitcases from Bobby's hands, and slid them in with the rest of the luggage. Behind them, his mom was looking in the back window and talking with the other two men who were going. She laughed at something one of them said. To Bobby, the laugh sounded about as real as a wooden leg. Mr. Biderman closed the trunk and looked down at Bobby. He was a narrow man with a wide face. His cheeks were always flushed. You could see his pink scalp and the tracks left by the teeth of his comb. He wore little round glasses with gold rims. To Bobby, his smile looked as real as his mother's laugh had sounded. Gonna play some baseball this summer, sport? Don Biderman bent his knees a little and cocked an imaginary bat. Bobby thought he looked like a dope. Yes, sir, I'm on the Wolves at Sterling House. I was hoping to make the Lions, but... Good, good. Mr. Biderman made a big deal of looking at his watch. The wide gold Twist-O-Flex band was dazzling in the early sunshine, and then patted Bobby's cheek. Bobby had to make a conscious effort not to cringe from his touch. Say, we got to get this wagon train rolling. Shake her easy, sport. Thanks for the loan of your mother. He turned away and escorted Liz around the Mercury to the passenger side. He did this with a hand pressed to her back. Bobby liked that even less than watching the guy smooch her cheek. He glanced at the well-padded, business-suited men in the rear seat. Dean was the other guy's name, he remembered. Just in time to see them elbowing each other. Both were grinning. Something's wrong here, Bobby thought. And as Mr. Biderman opened the passenger door for his mother, as she murmured her thanks and slid in, gathering her dress a little so it wouldn't wrinkle, he had an urge to tell her not to go. Rhode Island was too far away. Bridgeport would be too far away. She needed to stay home. He said nothing, though, only stood on the curb as Mr. Biderman closed her door and walked back around to the driver's side. He opened that door, paused, and then did his stupid little batter-up pantomime again. This time he added an asinine fanny wiggle. What a nimrod, Bobby thought. Don't do anything I wouldn't do, sport, he said. But if you do, name it after me, Cushman called from the back seat. Bobby didn't know exactly what that meant, but it must have been funny because Dean laughed, and Mr. Biderman tipped him one of those just-between-us guys winks. His mother was leaning in his direction. You'll be a good boy, Bobby, she said. I'll be back around 8 on Thursday night, no later than 10.
You're sure you're fine with that?
No, I'm not fine with it at all.
Don't go off with him, Mom. Don't go off with Mr. Biderman and those two grinning dopes sitting behind you. Those two nimrods. Please, don't.
Sure he is, Mr. Biderman said. He's a sport, ain't you, sport?
Bobby, she asked, not looking at Mr. Biderman, are you all set?
Yeah, he said. I'm a sport.
Mr. Biderman bellowed ferocious laughter.
Kill the pig, cut his throat, Bobby thought,
and dropped the mercury into gear.
Providence or bust, he cried,
and the car rolled away from the curb, swerving across to the other side of Broad Street and heading up toward Asher. Bobby stood on the sidewalk, waving as the murk passed Carol's house and Sully John's. He felt as if he had a bone in his heart. If this was some sort of premonition, a winkle, he never wanted to have another one. A hand fell on his shoulder. He looked around and saw Ted standing there in his bathrobe and slippers smoking a cigarette. His hair, which had yet to make its morning acquaintance with the brush, stood up around his ears in comical sprays of white.
So that was the boss, he said. Mr. Biedermeier, is it?
Biderman.
And how do you like him, Bobby?
Speaking with a low, bitter clarity, Bobby said, I trust him about as far as I could sling a piano.
Six. A dirty old man, Ted's casserole, a bad dream, village of the damned, down there.
An hour or so after seeing his mother off, Bobby went down to Field B behind Sterling House. There were no real games until afternoon. Nothing but three flies, six grounders, or Rolly Bat. But even Rolly Bat was better than nothing. On Field A, to the north, the little kids were futzing away at a game that vaguely resembled baseball. On Field C, to the south, some high school kids were playing what was almost the real thing. Shortly after, the town square clock had bonged noon, and the boys broke to go in search of the hot dog wagon. Bill Pratt asked, "Who is that weird guy over there?" He was pointing to a bench in the shade, and although Ted was wearing a trench coat, an old fedora hat, and dark glasses, Bobby recognized him at once. He guessed S.J. would have, too, if S.J. hadn't been at Camp Winnie. Bobby almost raised one hand in a wave, then didn't, because Ted was in disguise. Still, he'd come out to watch his downstairs friend play ball. Even though it wasn't a real game, Bobby felt an absurdly large lump rise in his throat. His mom had only come to watch him once in the 2 years he'd been playing, last August when his team had been in the Tri-Town Championships. And even then, she'd left in the fourth inning before Bobby connected for what proved to be the game-winning triple. "Somebody has to work around here, Bobby-O," she would have replied had he dared reproach her for that. "Your father didn't exactly leave us well off, you know." It was true, of course. She had to work. And Ted was retired. Except Ted had to stay clear of the low men in the yellow coats, and that was a full-time job. The fact that they didn't exist wasn't the point. Ted believed they did.
but had come out to see him play just the same.
"Probably some dirty old man wanting to put a suck job on one of the little kids,"
Harry Shaw said. Harry was small and tough, a boy going through life with his chin stuck out a mile. Being with Bill and Harry suddenly made Bobby homesick for Sully John, who had left on the Camp Winnie bus Monday morning at the brain-numbing hour of 5 a.m. S.J. didn't have much of a temper, and he was kind. Sometimes Bobby thought that was the best thing about Sully. He was kind. From Field C there came the hefty crack of a bat, an authoritative, full-contact sound which none of the Field B boys could yet produce. It was followed by savage roars of approval that made Bill, Harry, and Bobby look a little nervously in that direction. "St. Gabe's boys," Bill said. "They think they own Field C." "Cruddy catlicks," Harry said. "Catlicks are sissies. I could take any one of them." "How about 15 or 20?" Bill asked, and Harry was silent. Up ahead, glittering like a mirror, was the hot dog wagon. Bobby touched the buck in his pocket. Ted had given it to him out of the envelope his mother had left, then had put the envelope itself behind the toaster, telling Bobby to take what he needed when he needed it. Bobby was almost exalted by this level of trust.
"Look on the bright side," Bill said. "Maybe those St. Gabe's boys will beat up the dirty old man."
When they got to the wagon, Bobby bought only one hot dog instead of the two he had been planning on. His appetite seemed to have shrunk. When they got back to Field B, where the Wolves' coaches had now appeared with the equipment cart, the bench Ted had been sitting on was empty.
"Come on, come on,"
Coach Terrell called, clapping his hands. "Who wants to play some baseball here?" That night, Ted cooked his famous casserole in the Garfields' oven. It meant more hot dogs, but in the summer of 1960, Bobby Garfield could have eaten hot dogs 3 times a day and had another at bedtime. He read stuff to Ted out of the newspaper while Ted put their dinner together. Ted only wanted to hear a couple of paragraphs about the impending Patterson-Johansson rematch, the one everybody was calling the fight of the century, but he wanted to hear every word of the article about tomorrow night's Albini-Haywood tilt at the Garden in New York. Bobby thought this moderately weird, but he was too happy to even comment on it, let alone complain. He couldn't remember ever having spent an evening without his mother. And he missed her, yet he was also relieved to have her gone for a little while. There had been a queer sort of tension running through the apartment for weeks now, maybe even for months. It was like an electrical hum, so constant that you got used to it and didn't realize how much a part of your life it had become until it was gone. That thought brought another of his mother's sayings to mind. "What are you thinking?" Ted asked as Bobby came over to get the plates. "That a change is as good as a rest," Bobby replied. "It's something my mom says. I hope she's having as good a time as I am."
"So do I, Bobby," Ted said.
He bent, opened the oven, checked their dinner.
"So do I."
The casserole was terrific, with canned B&M beans, the only kind Bobby really liked, and exotic, spicy hot dogs not from the supermarket, but from the butcher just off the town square. Bobby assumed Ted had bought these while wearing his disguise. All this came in a horseradish sauce that zinged in your mouth and then made you feel sort of sweaty in the face. Ted had 2 helpings. Bobby had 3, washing them down with glass after glass of grape Kool-Aid. Ted blanked out once during the meal, first saying he could feel them in the backs of his eyeballs, then lapsing either into some foreign language or outright gibberish, but the incident was brief and didn't cut into Bobby's appetite in the slightest. The blankouts were part of Ted, that was all, like his scuffling walk and the nicotine stains between the first 2 fingers of his right hand. They cleaned up together, Ted stowing the leftover casserole in the fridge and washing the dishes, Bobby drying and putting things away because he knew where everything went.
"Interested in taking a ride to Bridgeport with me tomorrow?" Ted asked as they worked. "We could go to the movies, the early matinee, and then I have to do an errand."
"Gosh, yeah," Bobby said. "What do you want to see?"
I'm open to suggestions, but I was thinking perhaps Village of the Damned, a British film. It's based on a very fine science fiction novel by John Wyndham. Would that suit? At first, Bobby was so excited he couldn't speak. He had seen the ads for Village of the Damned in the newspaper, all those spooky-looking kids with the glowing eyes, but hadn't thought he would ever actually get to see it. It sure wasn't the sort of Saturday matinee movie that would ever play at Harwich on the Square or the Asher Empire. Matinees in those theaters consisted mostly of big bug monster shows, westerns, or Audie Murphy war movies, and although his mother usually took him if she went to an evening show, she didn't like science fiction. Liz liked moody love stories like The Dark at the Top of the Stairs. Also, the theaters in Bridgeport weren't like the antique-y old Harwich, or the somehow business-like Empire with its plain undecorated marquee. The theaters in Bridgeport were like fairy castles. They had huge screens. Swag upon swag of velvety curtains covered them between shows. Ceilings where tiny lights twinkled in galactic profusion. Brilliant electric wall sconces and two balconies.
Bobby,
you bet, he said at last, thinking he probably wouldn't sleep tonight. I'd love it, but aren't you afraid of, you know?
We'll take a taxi instead of the bus. I can phone for another taxi to take us back home later. We'll be fine. I think they're moving away now, anyway. I don't sense them so clearly. Yet Ted glanced away when he said this. And to Bobby, he looked like a man trying to tell himself a story he can't quite believe. If the increasing frequency of his blankouts meant anything, Bobby thought, he had good reason to look that way.
Stop it. The Lowmen don't exist. They're no more real than Flash Gordon and Dale Arden. The things he asked you to look for are just things. Remember that, Bobby O. Just ordinary things.
With dinner cleared away, the two of them sat down to watch Bronco with Ty Harden. Not among the best of the so-called adult westerns. Cheyenne and Maverick were the best, but not bad either. Halfway through the show, Bobby let out a moderately loud fart. Ted's casserole had begun its work. He snuck a sideways glance to make sure Ted wasn't holding his nose and grimacing.
Nope, just watching the television, seemingly absorbed.
When a commercial came on, some actress selling refrigerators, Ted asked if Bobby would like a glass of root beer. Bobby said okay.
I thought I might help myself to one of the Alka-Seltzers I saw in the bathroom, Bobby. I may have eaten a bit too much.
As he got up, Ted let out a long, sonorous fart that sounded like a trombone. Bobby put his hands to his mouth and giggled. Ted gave him a rueful smile and left the room. Bobby's giggling forced out more farts, a little tooting stream of them, and when Ted came back with a fizzy glass of Alka-Seltzer in one hand and a foaming glass of Heyer's root beer in the other, Bobby was laughing so hard the tears streamed down his cheeks and hung off his jawline like raindrops.
"This should help fix us up," Ted said, and when he bent to hand Bobby his root beer, a loud honk came from behind him. "Goose just flew out of my ass," he added matter-of-factly, and Bobby laughed so hard that he could no longer sit in his chair. He slithered out of it and lay in a boneless heap on the floor.
"Ah, I'll be right back," Ted told him. "There's something else we need."
He left open the door between the apartment and the foyer so Bobby could hear him going up the stairs. By the time Ted got to the third floor, Bobby had managed to crawl into his chair again. He didn't think he'd ever laugh so hard in his life. He drank some of his root beer, then farted again.
"Goose just flew out, but he couldn't finish. He flopped back in his chair and howled, shaking his head from side to side.
The stairs creaked as Ted came back down. When he re-entered the apartment, he had his fan with the electric cord looped neatly around the base under one arm.
"Your mother was right about this," he said.
When he bent to plug it in, another goose flew out of his ass.
"She usually is," Bobby said. And that struck them both funny.
They sat in the living room with the fan rotating back and forth, stirring the increasingly fragrant air. Bobby thought if he didn't stop laughing soon, his head would pop.
When Bronco was over, by then Bobby had lost all track of the story. He helped Ted pull out the couch. The bed, which had been hiding inside it, didn't look all that great. But Liz had made it up with some spare sheets and blankets, and Ted said it would be fine. Bobby brushed his teeth, then looked out from the door of his bedroom at Ted, who was sitting on the end of the sofa bed and watching the news. "Good night," Bobby said. Ted looked over to him, and for a moment Bobby thought Ted would get up, cross the room, give him a hug and maybe a kiss. Instead of that, he sketched a funny, awkward little salute. "Sleep well, Bobby." "Thanks." Bobby closed his bedroom door, turned off the light, got into bed, and spread his heels to the corners of the mattress. As he looked up into the dark, he remembered the morning Ted had taken hold of his shoulders, then laced his bunchy old hands together behind his neck. Their faces that day had been almost as close as his and Carol's had been on the Ferris wheel just before they kissed. The day he had argued with his mother. The day he had known about the money taped in the catalog. Also the day he had won 90 cents from Mr. McQuown. "Go buy yourself a martini," Mr. McQuown had said. Had it come from Ted? Had the winkle come from Ted touching him? "Yeah," Bobby whispered in the dark. "Yeah, I think it probably did. What if he touches me again that way?" Bobby was still considering this idea when he fell asleep. He dreamed that people were chasing his mother through the jungle. Jack and Peggy, the Liplins, and Don Biderman, Cushman and Dean. His mother was wearing her new dress from Gowns by Lucy, the black one with the thin straps on it had been torn in places by thorns and branches. Her stockings were in tatters. They looked like strips of dead skin hanging off her legs. Her eyes were deep sweat holes gleaming with terror. The boys chasing her were naked. Biderman and the other two were wearing their business suits. All of them had alternating streaks of red and white paint on their faces. All were brandishing spears and shouting, "Kill the pig, slit her throat. Kill the pig, drink her blood. Kill the pig, strew her guts." He woke in the gray light of dawn, shivering, and got up to use the bathroom. By the time he went back to bed, he could no longer remember precisely what he had dreamed. He slept for another 2 hours and woke up to the good smells of bacon and eggs. Bright summer sunshine was slanting in his bedroom window, and Ted was making breakfast. Village of the Damned was the last and greatest movie of Bobby Garfield's childhood. It was the first and greatest movie of what came after childhood. A dark period when he was often bad and always confused. A Bobby Garfield he felt he didn't really know. The cop who arrested him for the first time had blonde hair. And what came to Bobby's mind as the cop led him away from the mom-and-pop store Bobby had broken into, by then he and his mother were living in a suburb north of Boston, were all those blonde kids in Village of the Damned. The cop could have been one of them, all grown up. The movie was playing at the Criterion, the very avatar of those Bridgeport dream palaces Bobby had been thinking about the night before. It was in black and white, but the contrasts were sharp, not all fuzzy like on the zenith back in the apartment, and the images were enormous. So were the sounds, especially the shivery theremin music that played when the Midwich children really started to use their power. Bobby was enthralled by the story, understanding even before the first 5 minutes were over that it was a real story, the way Lord of the Flies had been a real story. The people seemed like real people, which made the make-believe parts scarier. He guessed that Sully John would have been bored with it except for the ending. SJ liked to see giant scorpions crushing Mexico City or Rodan stomping Tokyo. Beyond that, his interest in what he called creature features was limited. But Sully wasn't here, and for the first time since he left, Bobby was glad. They were in time for the 1 o'clock matinee, and the theater was almost deserted. Ted, wearing his fedora and with his dark glasses folded into the breast pocket of his shirt, bought a big bag of popcorn, a box of dots, a Coke for Bobby, and a root beer, of course, for himself. Every now and then, he would pass Bobby the popcorn or the candy, and Bobby would take some, but he was hardly aware that he was eating, let alone of what he was eating. The movie began with everyone in the British village of Midwich falling asleep. A man who was driving a tractor at the time of the event was killed. So was a woman who fell face first onto a lighted stove burner. The military was notified, and they sent a reconnaissance plane to take a look. The pilot fell asleep as soon as he was over Midwich airspace. The plane crashed. A soldier with a rope around his middle walked 10 or 12 paces into the village, then swooned into a deep sleep. When he was dragged back, he awakened as soon as he was hauled over the sleep line that had been painted across the highway. Everyone in Midwich woke up eventually, and everything seemed to be all right, until a few weeks later, the women in town discovered they were pregnant. Old women, young women, even girls Carol Gerber's age, all pregnant, and the children they gave birth to were those spooky kids from the poster, the ones with the blonde hair and the glowing eyes. Although the movie never said, Bobby figured the children of the damned must have been caused by some sort of outer space phenomenon, like the pod people in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. In any case, they grew up faster than normal kids. They were super smart. They could make people do what they wanted, and they were ruthless. When one father tried to discipline his particular child of the damned, all the kids clubbed together and directed their thoughts at the offending grown-up, their eyes glowing, that theremin music so pulsing and strange that Bobby's arms broke out in goosebumps as he drank his Coke, until the guy put a shotgun to his head and killed himself. That part wasn't shown, and Bobby was glad. The hero was George Sanders. His wife gave birth to one of the blonde children. S.J. would have scoffed at George, called him a queer bastard or a golden oldie, but Bobby found him a welcome change from heroes like Randolph Scott, Richard Carlson, and the inevitable Audie Murphy. George was really sort of ripshit in a weird English way. In the words of Denny Rivers, old George knew how to lay chili. He wore special cool ties and combed his hair back tight to his skull. He didn't look as though he could beat up a bunch of saloon baddies or anything, but he was the only guy from Midwich the children of the damned would have anything to do with. In fact, they drafted him to be their teacher. Bobby couldn't imagine Randolph Scott or Audie Murphy teaching a bunch of super smart kids from outer space anything. In the end, George Sanders was also the one who got rid of them. He had discovered he could keep the children from reading his mind, for a little while anyway, if he imagined a brick wall in his head with all his most secret thoughts behind it. And after everyone had decided the children must go, you could teach them math, but not why it was bad to punish someone by making him drive over a cliff. Sanders put a time bomb into his briefcase and took it into the schoolroom. That was the only place where the children, Bobby understood in some vague way that they were only supernatural versions of Jack Merridew and his hunters in Lord of the Flies, were all together. They sensed that Sanders was hiding something from them. In the movie's final excruciating sequence, you could see bricks flying out of the wall Sanders had constructed in his head. flying faster and faster as the children of the dam pried into him, trying to find out what he was concealing. At last, they uncovered the image of the bomb in the briefcase, 8 or 9 sticks of dynamite wired up to an alarm clock. You saw their creepy golden eyes widen with understanding, but they didn't have time to do anything. The bomb exploded. Bobby was shocked that the hero died. Randolph Scott never died in the Saturday matinee movies at the Empire. Neither did Audie Murphy or Richard Carlson. But he understood that George Sanders had given his life for the greater good of all. He thought he understood something else as well. Ted's blankouts. While Ted and Bobby had been visiting Midwich, the day in southern Connecticut had turned hot and glaring. Bobby didn't like the world much after a really good movie. In any case, for a little while, it felt like an unfair joke full of people with dull eyes, small plans, and facial blemishes. He sometimes thought if the world had a plot, it would be so much better. "Brodigan and Garfield hit the bricks," Ted exclaimed as they stepped from beneath the marquee, a banner reading, "Come in, it's cool inside," hung from the marquee's front. "What'd you think? Did you enjoy it?"
"It was great," Bobby said. "Fantabulous. Thanks for taking me. It was practically the best movie I ever saw. How about when he had the dynamite? Did you think he'd be able to fool them?"
"Well, I'd read the book, remember? Will you read it, do you think?"
"Yes."
Bobby felt, in fact, a sudden urge to bolt back to Harwich, running the whole distance down the Connecticut Pike and Asher Avenue in the hot sunshine so he could borrow the Midwich Cuckoos with his new adult library card at once.
"Did he write any other science fiction stories?"
"John Wyndham? Oh, yes, quite a few. And will, no doubt, write more. One nice thing about science fiction and mystery writers is that they rarely dither 5 years between books. That is the prerogative of serious writers who drink whiskey and have affairs."
"Are the others as good as the one we just saw?"
"The Day of the Triffids is as good. The Kraken Wakes is even better."
"What's a kraken?"
They had reached a street corner and were waiting for the light to change. Ted made a spooky, big-eyed face and bent down toward Bobby with his hands on his knees. "It's a monster," he said, doing a pretty good Boris Karloff imitation. They walked on, talking first about the movie, and then about whether or not there really might be life in outer space, and then on to the special cool ties George Sanders had worn in the movie. Ted told him that kind of tie was called an ascot. When Bobby next took notice of their surroundings, they had come to a part of Bridgeport he had never been in before. When he came to the city with his mom, they stuck to downtown, where the big stores were. The stores here were small and crammed together. None sold what the big department stores did, clothes and appliances and shoes and toys. Bobby saw signs for locksmiths, check cashing services, used books. "Rod's Guns," read one sign. "Whoa Fat Noodle Company," read another. "Photo Finishing," read a third. Next to Woe Fat was a shop selling special souvenirs. There was something weirdly like the Seven Rock Midway about this street, so much so that Bobby almost expected to see the Monty Man standing on a street corner with his makeshift table and his lobster-back playing cards. Bobby tried to peer through the special souvenirs window when they passed, but it was covered by a big bamboo blind. He'd never heard of a store covering their show window during business hours. Who'd want a special souvenir of Bridgeport, do you think?
"Well, I don't think they really sell souvenirs," Ted said. "I guess they sell items of sexual nature. Few of them strictly legal."
Bobby had questions about that, a billion or so, but felt it best to be quiet. Outside a pawn shop with 3 golden balls hanging over the door, he paused to look at a dozen straight razors which had been laid out on velvet with their blades partly open. They'd been arranged in a circle, and the result was strange and, to Bobby, beautiful. Looking at them was like looking at something removed from a deadly piece of machinery. The razor's handles were much more exotic than the handle of the one Ted used, too. One looked like ivory, another like ruby, etched with thin golden lines, a third like crystal. "If you bought one of those, you'd be shaving in style, wouldn't you?" Bobby asked. He thought Ted would smile, but he didn't. "When people buy razors like that, they don't shave with them, Bobby." "What do you mean?" Ted wouldn't tell him, but he did buy him a sandwich called a gyro in a Greek delicatessen. It came in a folded-over piece of homemade bread and was oozing a dubious white sauce, which to Bobby looked quite a lot like pimple pus. He forced himself to try it, because Ted said they were good. It turned out to be the best sandwich he'd ever eaten, as meaty as a hot dog or a hamburger from the Colony Diner, but with an exotic taste that no hamburger or hot dog had ever had. And it was great to be eating on the sidewalk, strolling along with his friend, looking and being looked at. "What do they call this part of town?" Bobby asked. "Does it have a name?"
"These days, who knows?" Ted said and shrugged. "They used to call it Greek Town. Then the Italians came, the Puerto Ricans, and now the Negroes. There's a novelist named David Goodis, the kind the college teachers never read, a genius of the drugstore paperback displays, who calls it Down There. He says every city has a neighborhood like this, one where you can buy sex or marijuana or a parrot that talks dirty, where the men sit talking on stoops like those men across the street, where the women always seem to be yelling for their kids to come in unless they want a whipping, and where the wine always comes in a paper sack." Ted pointed into the gutter, where the neck of a Thunderbird bottle did indeed poke out of a brown bag. "It's just down there. That's what David Goodis says. A place where you don't have any use for your last name, and you can buy almost anything if you have cash in your pocket." Down there, Bobby thought, watching a trio of olive-skinned teenagers in gang jackets. Watch them as they passed. This is the land of straight razors and special souvenirs. The Criterion and Muncie's department store had never seemed so far away, and Broad Street, that, and all of Harwich could have been in another solar system. At last, they came to a place called the Corner Pocket Pool and Billiards Automatic Games Rheingold on Tap. There was also one of those banners reading, "Come in, it's cool inside." As Bobby and Ted passed beneath it, a young man in a strappy T-shirt and a chocolate-colored stingy brim like the kind Frank Sinatra wore came out the door. He had a long, thin case in one hand. "That's his pool cue," Bobby thought with fright and amazement. "He's got his pool cue in that case like it was a guitar or something." "Who a hip cat, daddy-o?" he asked Bobby, then grinned. Bobby grinned back. The kid with the pool cue case made a gum with his finger and pointed it at Bobby. Bobby made a gum with his own finger and pointed it back. The kid nodded as if to say, "Yeah, okay, you hip. We're both hip," and crossed the street, snapping the fingers of his free hand and bopping to the music in his head. Ted looked up the street in one direction, then down in the other. Ahead of them, three Negro children were capering in the spray of a partly opened hydrant. Back the way they'd come, two young men, one white, the other maybe Puerto Rican, were taking the hubcaps off an old Ford, working with the rapid seriousness of doctors performing an operation. Ted looked at them, sighed, then looked at Bobby. "The pocket's no place for a kid, even in the middle of the day. But I'm not going to leave you out on the street. Come on." He took Bobby by the hand and led him inside. Seven. In the pocket. The shirt right off his back. Outside the William Penn. The French sex kitten. What struck Bobby first was the smell of beer. It was impacted, as if folks had been drinking in here since the days when the pyramids were still in the planning stages.
Next was the sound of a TV, not turned bandstand, but to one of the late afternoon soap operas, Oh John, Oh Marcia shows, was what his mother called them, and the click of pool balls. Only after these things had registered did his eyes chip in their own input, because they needed to adjust. The place was very dim. And it was long, Bobby saw. To their right was an archway, and beyond it a room that appeared almost endless. Most of the pool tables were covered, but a few stood in brilliant islands of light where men strolled languidly about, pausing every now and then to bend and shoot. Other men, hardly visible, sat in high seats along the wall watching. One was getting his shoes shined. He looked about 1,000. Straight ahead was a big room filled with Gottlieb pinball machines, a billion red and orange lights, stuttered stomachache colors off a large sign which read, "If you tilt the same machine twice, you will be asked to leave." A young man wearing another stingy brim hat, apparently the approved headgear for the bad motor scooters residing down there, was bent over Frontier Patrol, working the flippers frantically. A cigarette hung off his lower lip, the smoke rising past his face and the whorls of his combed-back hair. He was wearing a jacket tied around his waist and turned inside out. To the left of the lobby was a bar. It was from here that the sound of the TV and the smell of beer was coming. Three men sat there, each surrounded by empty stools hunched over Pilsner glasses. They didn't look like the happy beer drinkers you saw in the ads. To Bobby, they looked like the loneliest people on earth. He wondered why they didn't at least huddle up and talk a little. Closer by them was a desk. A fat man came rolling through the door behind it, and for a moment Bobby could hear the low sound of a radio playing. The fat man had a cigar in his mouth and was wearing a shirt covered with palm trees. He was snapping his fingers like the cool cat with the pool cue case, and under his breath he was singing like this, "Choo-choo-cha." Bobby recognized the tune, Tequila by the Champs. "Who you, buddy?" the fat man asked Ted. "I don't know you, and he can't be in here anyway, can't you read?" He jerked a fat thumb with a dirty nail at another sign, this one posted on the desk, B-21 or Be Gone. "You don't know me, but I think you know Jimmy Girardi," Ted said politely. "He told me you were the man to see, if you're Len Files, that is." "I'm Len," the man said. All at once, he seemed considerably warmer. He held out a hand, so white and pudgy that it looked like the gloves Mickey and Donald and Goofy wore in the cartoons. "You know Jimmy G, huh? Goddamn, Jimmy G. Why, his grandpa's back there getting the shine. He gets his boats shined a lot these days." Len Files tipped Ted a wink. Ted smiled and shook the guy's hand. "That's your kid?" Len Files asked, bending over his desk to get a closer look at Bobby. Bobby could smell sensen mints and cigars on his breath, sweat on his body. The collar of his shirt was speckled with dandruff. "He's a friend," Ted said, and Bobby thought he might actually explode with happiness. "I didn't want to leave him on the street." "Yeah, unless you're willing to have to pay to get him back," Len Files agreed. "You remind me of somebody, kid." "Now, why is that?" Bobby shook his head, a little frightened to think he looked like anybody Len Files might know. The fat man barely paid attention to Bobby's headshake. He had straightened and was looking at Ted again. "I can't be having kids in here, mister." Ted brought again. He offered his hand. Len Files shook it. "You know how it is, Ted. People in a business like mine, the cops keep tabs." "Of course, but he'll stand right here, won't you, Bobby?"
"Sure,"
Bobby said. "And our business won't take long, but it's a good little bit of business, Mr. Files." "Len." Len, of course, Bobby thought, just Len, because in here was down there. "As I say, Len, this is a good piece of business I want to do. I think you'll agree." "If you know Jimmy G, you know I don't do the nickels and dimes," Len said. "I leave the nickels and dimes to the niggers. What are we talking here? Patterson Johansson? Albini Haywood at the garden tomorrow night?" Len's eyes widened. Then his fat and unshaven cheeks spread in a smile. "Man, oh man, oh Manischewitz, we need to explore this." "We certainly do." Len Files came out from around the desk, took Ted by the arm, and started to lead him toward the pool room. Then he stopped and swung back.
"Is it Bobby? When you're home and got your feet up, pal?"
"Yes, sir."
"Yes, sir, Bobby Garfield," he would have said anywhere else, but this was down there, and he thought just plain Bobby would suffice.
"Well, Bobby, I know those pinball machines probably look good to you, and you probably got a quarter or two in your pocket, but do what Adam didn't and resist the temptation. Can you do that?"
"Yes, sir."
"I won't be long," Ted told him, and then allowed Len Files to lead him through the arch and into the pool room. They walked past the men in the high chairs, and Ted stopped to speak to the one getting his shoes shined. Next to Jimmy G's grandfather, Ted Brodigan looked young. The old man peered up, and Ted said something. The two men laughed into each other's faces. Jimmy G's grandfather had a good, strong laugh for an old fellow. Ted reached out both hands and patted his sallow cheeks with gentle affection. That made Jimmy G's grandfather laugh again. Then Ted let Len draw him into a curtained alcove past the other men in the other chairs. Bobby stood by the desk as if rooted, but Len hadn't said anything about not looking around, and so he did, in all directions. The walls were covered with beer signs and calendars that showed girls with most of their clothes off. One was climbing over a fence in the country. Another was getting out of a packer with most of her skirt in her lap and her garters showing. Behind the desk were more signs, most expressing some negative concept. "If you don't like our town, look for a timetable. Don't send a boy to do a man's job. There's no such thing as a free lunch. No checks accepted. No credit. Crying towels are not provided by the management," and a big red button marked "Police Call." Suspended from the ceiling on a loop of dusty wire were cellophane packages, some marked "Ginseng Oriental Love Root" and others "Spanish Delight." Bobby wondered if they were vitamins of some kind. Why would they sell vitamins in a place like this? The young guy in the room full of automatic games whapped the side of Frontier Patrol, stepped back, gave the machine the finger. Then he strolled into the lobby area, adjusting his hat. Bobby made his finger into a gun and pointed it at him. The young man looked surprised, then grinned and pointed back as he headed for the door. He loosened the tied arms of his jacket as he went. "Can't wear no club jacket in here," he said, noting Bobby's wide-eyed curiosity. "Can't even show your fucking colors, rules of the house." "Oh?" The young guy smiled and raised his hand. Traced in blue ink on the back was a devil's pitchfork. "But I got the sign, little brother. See it?" "Heck yeah. A tattoo." Bobby was faint with envy. The kid saw it. His smile widened into a grin full of white teeth. "Fucking Diabolos, mano. Best club, fucking Diabolos. Rule the streets. All others are pussy." "The streets down here." "Fucking right down here. Where else is there? Rock on, baby brother. I like you. You got a good look on you. Fucking crew cut sucks, though." The door opened. There was a gasp of hot air and street life noise, and the guy was gone. A little wicker basket on the desk caught Bobby's eye. He tilted it so he could see in. It was full of key rings with plastic fobs, red and blue and green. Bobby picked one out so he could read the gold printing, "The Corner, Pocket, Billiards, Pool, Auto Games, Kenmore, 8-2127. "Go on, kid, take it." Bobby was so startled he almost knocked the basket of keyrings to the floor. The woman had come through the same door as Len Files, and she was even bigger, almost as big as the circus fat lady. But she was as light on her feet as a ballerina. Bobby looked up, and she was just there, looming over him. She was Len's sister, had to be. "I'm sorry," Bobby muttered, returning the key ring he'd picked up and pushing the basket back from the edge of the desk with little pats of his fingers. He might have succeeded in pushing it right over the far side if the fat woman hadn't stopped it with one hand. She was smiling, didn't look a bit mad, which to Bobby was a tremendous relief.
Really, I'm not being sarcastic. You should take one.
She held out one of the key rings. It had a green fob. They're just cheap little things, but they're free. We give them away for the advertising. Like matches, you know. Although, I wouldn't give a pack of matches to a kid. Don't smoke, do you?
No, ma'am.
That's making a good start. Stay away from the booze, too. Here, take. Don't turn down for free in this world, kid. There isn't much of it going around.
Bobby took the key ring with the green fob. Thank you, ma'am. It's neat.
He put the key ring in his pocket, knowing he would have to get rid of it. If his mother found such an item, she wouldn't be happy. She'd have 20 questions, as Sully would say, maybe even 30.
What's your name?
Bobby. He waited to see if she would ask for his last name, and was secretly delighted when she didn't.
I'm Alana.
She held out a hand crusted with rings. They twinkled like the pinball lights.
You here with your dad?
With my friend, Bobby said. I think he's making a bet on the Haywood-Albini prize fight.
Alana looked alarmed and amused at the same time.
She leaned forward with one finger to her red lips. She made a shh sound at Bobby and blew out a strong, licorice smell with it.
Don't say bet in here, she cautioned him. This is a billiard parlor. Always remember that and you'll always be fine.
Okay. You're a handsome little devil, Bobby, and you look...
She paused. Do I know your father, maybe? Is that possible?
Bobby shook his head, but doubtfully. He had reminded Len of someone, too. My dad's dead. He died a long time ago. He always added this, so people wouldn't get all gushy.
What was his name?
But before he could say, Alana Files said it herself. It came out of her painted mouth like a magic word.
Was it Randy? Randy... Garrett? Randy Greer? Something like that?
For a moment, Bobby was so flabbergasted he couldn't speak. It felt as if all the breath had been sucked out of his lungs.
Randall Garfield.
But how... She laughed, delighted. Her bosom heaved.
Well, mostly your hair, but also the freckles and this here's ski jump.
She bent forward, and Bobby could see the tops of smooth white breasts that looked as big as water barrels. She skidded one finger lightly down his nose.
He came in here to play pool?
Nah. Said he wasn't much of a stick. He'd drink a beer. Also, sometimes... She made a quick gesture, then dealing from an invisible deck. It made Bobby think of McQuown.
Yeah, Bobby said. He never met an inside straight he didn't like. That's what I heard.
Well, I don't know about that, but... He was a nice guy. He could come in here on a Monday night when the place is always like a grave, and in half an hour or so he'd have everybody laughing. He'd play that song by Joe Stafford, I can't remember the name, and make Lenny turn up the jukebox. Real sweetie, kid. That's mostly why I remember him. A sweetie with red hair is a rare commodity. He wouldn't buy a drunk a drink. He had a thing about that, but otherwise he'd give you the shirt right off his back. All you had to do was ask.
But he lost a lot of money, I guess, Bobby said.
He couldn't believe he was having this conversation that he had met someone who had known his father. Yet he supposed a lot of finding out happened like this, completely by accident. You were just going along, minding your own business, and all at once the past sideswiped you.
Randy?
She looked surprised. No, he'd come in for a drink maybe 3 times a week, you know, if he happened to be in the neighborhood. He was in real estate or insurance or selling to some one of those real estate, Bobby said. It was real estate. And there was an office down here he'd visit for the industrial properties, I guess, if it was real estate. You sure it wasn't medical supplies?
No, real estate.
It's funny how your memory works, she said. Some things stay clear, but mostly time goes by and green turns blue. All of the suit and tie businesses are gone down here now, anyway. She shook her head sadly. Bobby wasn't interested in how the neighborhood had gone to blazes. But when he did play, he lost. He was always trying to fill inside straights and stuff.
Did your mother tell you that?
Bobby was silent. Alana shrugged. Interesting things happened all up and down her front when she did.
Well, that's between you and her.
And hey, maybe your dad threw his dough around in other places. All I know is that in here, he'd just sit in once or twice a month with guys he knew, play until maybe midnight, then go home. If he left a big winner or a big loser, I probably remember. I don't, so he probably broke even most nights he played. Which, by the way, makes him a pretty good poker player. Better than most back there. She rolled her eyes in the direction Ted and her brother had gone. Bobby looked at her with growing confusion. "Your father didn't exactly leave us well off," his mother liked to say. There was the lapsed life insurance policy, the stack of unpaid bills. "Little did I know," his mother had said just this spring, and Bobby was beginning to think that fit him as well. "Little did I know."
"He was such a good-looking guy, your dad,"
Elena said. "Bob Hope knows and all. I guess you got that to look forward to. You favor him. You got a girlfriend?" "Yes, ma'am." Were the unpaid bills a fiction? Was that possible? Had the life insurance policy actually been cashed and socked away? Maybe in a bank account instead of between the pages of the Sears catalog? It was a horrible thought, somehow. Bobby couldn't imagine why his mother would want him to think his dad was a low man with red hair, a bad guy, if he really wasn't. But there was something about the idea that felt true. She could get mad. That was the thing about his mother. She could get so mad. And then she might say anything. It was possible that his father, who his mother had never once in Bobby's memory called Randy, had given too many people too many shirts right off his back and consequently made Liz Garfield mad. Liz Garfield didn't give away shirts, not off her back or from anywhere else. You had to save your shirts in this world because life wasn't fair. "What's her name?" "Liz." He felt dazed the way he'd felt coming out of the dark theater into the bright light. "Like Liz Taylor?" Elena looked pleased. "That's a nice name for a girlfriend." Bobby laughed, a little embarrassed. "No, my mother's Liz. My girlfriend's name is Carol." "She pretty?" "A real hotsy-totsy," he said, grinning and wiggling one hand from side to side. He was delighted when Elena roared with laughter. She reached over the desk, the flesh of her upper arm hanging like some fantastic wad of dough, and pinched his cheek. It hurt a little, but he liked it. "Cute kid. Can I tell you something?"
"Sure, what?"
"Just because a man likes to play little cards, that doesn't make him Attila the Hun. You know that, don't you?" Bobby nodded hesitantly, then more firmly. "Your ma is your ma. I don't say nothing against anybody's ma because I love my own, but not everybody's ma approves of cards or pool or places like this. It's a point of view, but that's all it is. Get the picture?" "Yes," Bobby said. He did. He got the picture. He felt very strange, like laughing and crying at the same time. My dad was here, he thought. This seemed, at least for the time being, much more important than any lies his mother might have told about him. My dad was here. He might have stood right where I'm standing now. "I'm glad I look like him," he blurted. Elena nodded, smiling. "You coming in here like that, just walking in off the street. Pfft, what are the odds?" "I don't know, but thanks for telling me about him. Thanks a lot." "He'd play that Joe Stafford song all night if you let him," Elena said. "Now don't you go wandering off." "No, ma'am." "No, Elena," Bobby grinned. "Elena." She blew him a kiss, as his mother sometimes did, and laughed when Bobby pretended to catch it. Then she went back through the door. Bobby could see what looked like a living room beyond it. There was a big cross on one wall. He reached into his pocket, hooked a finger through the key ring. It was, he thought, a special souvenir of his visit down there, and imagined himself riding down Broad Street on the Schwinn from the Western Auto. He was heading for the park. He was wearing a chocolate-colored stingy brim hat cocked back on his head. His hair was long and combed in a duck's ass. No more crew cut. Later for you, Jack. Tied around his waist was a jacket with his colors on it. Riding the back of his hand was a blue tattoo stamped deep and forever. Outside Field B, Carol would be waiting for him. She'd be watching him ride up. She'd be thinking, oh, you crazy boy, as he swung the Schwinn around in a tight circle, spraying gravel toward, but not on, her white sneakers. Crazy. Yes, a bad motor scooter and a mean go-getter. Len Files and Ted were coming back now, both of them looking happy. Len, in fact, looked like the cat that ate the canary, as Bobby's mother often said. Ted paused to pass another, briefer word with the old guy, who nodded and smiled. When Ted and Len got back to the lobby area, Ted started toward the telephone booth just inside the door. Len took his arm and steered him toward the desk instead. As Ted stepped behind it, Len ruffled Bobby's hair. I know who you look like, he said. It come to me while I was in the back room. Your dad was Garfield. Randy Garfield. Bobby looked up at Len, who so resembled his sister, and thought how odd and sort of wonderful it was to be linked that way to your own blood kin. Linked so closely, people who didn't even know you could sometimes pick you out of a crowd. Did you like him, Mr. Files? Who, Randy? Sure, he was a hell of a gizmo. But Len Files seemed a little vague. He hadn't noticed Bobby's father in the same way his sister had, Bobby decided. Len probably wouldn't remember about the Joe Stafford song or how Randy Garfield would give you the shirt right off his back. He wouldn't give a drunk a drink, though. He wouldn't do that. Your pal's all right, too, Len went on, more enthusiastic now. I like the high class. And the high class likes me, but I don't get real shooters like him in here often. He turned to Ted, who was hunting nearsightedly through the phone book. Try Circle Taxi Kenmore 6, 7400. Thanks, Ted said. Don't mention it. Len brushed past Ted and went through the door behind the desk. Bobby caught another brief glimpse of the living room and the big cross. When the door shut, Ted looked over at Bobby and said, You bet $500 on a prize fight, and you don't have to use the payphone like the rest of the schmucks. Such a deal, huh? Bobby felt as if all the wind had been sucked out of him. You bet $500? On Hurricane Haywood? Ted shook a Chesterfield out of his pack, put it in his mouth, lit it around a grin. Good God, no, he said. On Albini. After he called the cab, Ted took Bobby over to the bar and ordered them both root beers. He doesn't know I don't really like root beer, Bobby thought. It seemed another piece in the puzzle somehow, the puzzle of Ted. Len served them himself, saying nothing about how Bobby shouldn't be sitting at the bar. He was a nice kid, but just stinking the place up with his under-21-ness. Apparently a free phone call wasn't all you got when you bet $500 on a prize fight. And not even the excitement of the bet could long distract Bobby from a certain dull certainty which stole much of his pleasure in hearing that his father hadn't been such a bad guy after all. The bet had been made to earn some run-out money. Ted was leaving. The taxi was a checker with a huge back seat. The driver was deeply involved in the Yankees game on the radio to the point where he sometimes talked back to the announcer. Files and his sister knew your father, didn't they? It wasn't really a question. Yeah, Alana especially. She thought he was a real nice guy. Bobby paused. But that's not what my mother thinks. I imagine your mother saw a side of him. Alana Files never did, Ted replied, more than one. People are like diamonds in that way, Bobby. They have many sides. But Mom said... It was too complicated. She never exactly said anything, really. Only sort of suggested stuff. He didn't know how to tell Ted that his mother had sides, too. And some of them made it hard to believe those things she never quite came out and said. And when you got right down to it, how much did he really want to know? His father was dead, after all. His mother wasn't, and he had to live with her. And he had to love her. He had no one else to love, not even Ted, because... "When you going?" Bobby asked in a low voice. "After your mother gets back," Ted sighed, glanced out the window, then looked down at his hands, which were folded on one crossed knee. He didn't look at Bobby, not yet. "Probably Friday morning. I can't collect my money until tomorrow night. I got 4-1 on Albini. That's 2 grand. My good pal Lenny will have to phone New York to make the cover." They crossed a canal bridge. And down there was back there. Now, they were in the part of the city Bobby had traveled with his mother. The men on the streets wore coats and ties. The women wore hose instead of Bobby socks. None of them looked like Atlantophiles, and Bobby didn't think many of them would smell of liquor if they went shh, either. Not at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. "I know why you didn't bet on Patterson Johansson," Bobby said. "It's because you don't know who'll win." "I think Patterson will this time," Ted said, "because this time he's prepared for Johansson. I might flutter $2 on Floyd Patterson, but 500, to bet 500, you must either know or be crazy." "The Albini-Haywood fight is fixed, isn't it?" Ted nodded. "I knew when you read that Kleindienst was involved, and I guessed that Albini was supposed to win." "You've made other bets on boxing matches where Mr. Kleindienst was a manager." Ted said nothing for a moment, only looked out the window. On the radio, someone hit a comebacker to Whitey Ford. Ford fielded the ball and threw to Moose Scourin at first. Now there were 2 down in the top of the 8th. At last, Ted said, "It could have been Haywood. It wasn't likely, but it could have been." Then, "Did you see the old man back there, the one in the shoeshine chair?" "Sure, you patted him on the cheeks." "That's Arthur Girardi. Files lets him hang around because he used to be connected. That's what Files thinks, used to be. Now he's just some old fellow who comes in to get his shoes shined at 10 and then forgets and comes in to get them shined again at 3. Files thinks he's just an old fellow who don't know from nothing, as they say. Girardi lets him think whatever he wants to think. If Files said that the moon was green cheese, Girardi wouldn't say boo. Old G, he comes in for the air conditioning, and he's still connected." "Connected to Jimmy G?" "To all sorts of guys." "Mr. Files didn't know the fight was fixed?" "No, not for sure. I thought he would. But old G knew, and he knew which one's supposed to take the dive." "Yes. That was my luck. Hurricane Haywood goes down in the 8th round. Then, next year, when the odds are better, the Hurricane gets his payday." "Would you have bet if Mr. Girardi hadn't been there?"
"Nope," Ted replied immediately.
"Then what would you have done for money when you go away?" Ted looked depressed at those words, "when you go away." He made as if to put an arm around Bobby's shoulders, then stopped himself. "There's always someone who knows something," he said. They were on Asher Avenue now, still in Bridgeport, but only a mile or so from the Harwich town line. Knowing what would happen, Bobby reached for Ted's big nicotine-stained hand. Ted swiveled his knees toward the door, taking his hands with him. Better not. Bobby didn't need to ask why. People put up signs that said, "Wet paint, do not touch," because if you put your hand on something newly painted, the stuff would get on your skin. You could wash it off, or it would wear off by itself in time, but for a while, it would be there. "Where will you go?"
"I don't know."
"I feel bad," Bobby said. He could feel tears prickling at the corners of his eyes. "If something happens to you, it's my fault. I saw things, the things you told me to look out for, but I didn't say anything. I didn't want you to go, so I told myself you were crazy, not about everything, just about the low men you thought were chasing you, and I didn't say anything. You gave me a job, and I muffed it." Ted's arm rose again. He lowered it, and settled for giving Bobby a quick pat on the leg instead. At Yankee Stadium, Tony Kubek had just doubled home 2 runs. The crowd was going wild.
But I knew, Ted said mildly.
Bobby stared at him. What? I don't get you.
I felt them getting closer. That's why my trances have grown so frequent. Yet I lied to myself, just as you did. For the same reasons, too. Do you think I want to leave you now, Bobby, when your mother is so confused and unhappy? In all honesty, I don't care so much for her sake. We don't get along. From the first second we laid eyes on each other, we didn't get along. But she is your mother, and...
What's wrong with her? Bobby asked. He remembered to keep his voice low, but he took Ted's arm and shook it. Tell me. You know. I know you do. Is it Mr. Biderman? Is it something about Mr. Biderman?
Ted looked out the window, brow furrowed, lips drawn down tightly. At last he sighed, pulled out his cigarettes, and lit one.
Bobby, he said, Mr. Biderman is not a nice man.
Your mother knows it, but she also knows that sometimes we have to go along with people who are not nice. Go along to get along, she thinks. And she has done this. She's done things over the last year that she's not proud of, but she has been careful. In some ways, she has needed to be as careful as I have, and whether I like her or not, I admire her for that.
What did she do? What did he make her do?
Something cold moved in Bobby's chest.
Why did Mr. Biderman take her to Providence?
For the real estate conference.
Is that all? Is that all?
I don't know. She didn't know.
Well, perhaps she has covered over what she knows and what she fears with what she hopes. I can't say.
Sometimes I can. Sometimes I know things very directly and clearly. The first moment I saw you, I knew that you wanted a bicycle, that getting one was very important to you, and you meant to earn the money for one this summer if you could. I admired your determination.
You touched me on purpose, didn't you?
Yes, indeed. The first time, anyway, I did it to know you a little. But friends don't spy. True friendship is about privacy, too. Besides, when I touch, I pass on a kind of, well, a kind of window. I think you know that. The second time I touched you, really touching, holding on, you know what I mean? That was a mistake, but not such an awful one. For a little while, you knew more than you should, but it wore off, didn't it? If I'd gone on, though, touching and touching the way people do when they're close, there'd come a point where things would change, where it wouldn't wear off. He raised his mostly smoked cigarette and looked at it distastefully, the way you smoke one too many of these and you're hooked for life.
Is my mother all right now?
Bobby asked, knowing that Ted couldn't tell him that.
Ted's gift, whatever it was, didn't stretch that far.
I don't know.
Ted suddenly stiffened. He was looking out the window at something up ahead. He smashed his cigarette into the armrest ashtray, doing it hard enough to send sparks scattering across the back of his hand. He didn't seem to feel them. Christ, he said. Oh, Christ, Bobby, we're in for it. Bobby leaned across his lap to look out the window, thinking in the back of his mind about what Ted had just been saying, touching and touching the way people do when they're close, even as he peered up Asher Avenue. Ahead was a 3-way intersection, Asher Avenue, Bridgeport Avenue, and the Connecticut Pike, all coming together at a place known as Puritan Square. Trolley tracks gleamed in the afternoon sun. Delivery trucks honked impatiently as they waited their turns to dart through the crush. A sweating policeman with a whistle in his mouth and white gloves on his hands was directing traffic. Off to the left was the William Penn Grill, a famous restaurant which was supposed to have the best steaks in Connecticut. Mr. Biderman had taken the whole office staff there after the agency sold the Waverly estate, and Bobby's mom had come home with about a dozen William Penn Grill books of matches. Its main claim to fame, his mom had once told Bobby, was that the bar was over the Harwich town line, but the restaurant proper was in Bridgeport. Parked in front, on the very edge of Puritan Square, was a DeSoto automobile of a purple Bobby had never seen before, had never even suspected. The color was so bright, it hurt his eyes to look at it. It hurt his whole head. Their cars will be like their yellow coats and sharp shoes and the greasy perfume stuff they use to slick back their hair, loud and vulgar. The purple car was loaded with swoops and darts of chrome. It had fender skirts. The hood ornament was huge. Chief DeSoto's head glittered in the hazy light like a fake jewel. The tires were fat white walls, and the hubcaps were spinners. There was a whip antenna on the back. From its tip, there hung a raccoon tail. "The low men," Bobby whispered. There was really no question. It was a DeSoto, but at the same time, it was like no car he had ever seen in his life. Something as alien as an asteroid. As they drew closer to the clogged three-way intersection, Bobby saw the upholstery was a metallic dragonfly green. The color nearly howled in contrast to the car's purple skin. There was white fur around the steering wheel. "Holy crow, it's them."
"You have to take your mind away," Ted said. He grabbed Bobby by the shoulders.
Up front, the Yankees blared on and on, the driver paying his two fares in the back seat no attention whatsoever, thank God for that much at least, and shook him once hard before letting him go. "You have to take your mind away, do you understand?" He did. George Sanders had built a brick wall behind which to hide his thoughts and plans from the children. Bobby had used Maury Wills once before, but he didn't think baseball was going to cut it this time. What would? Bobby could see the Asher Empire's marquee jutting out over the sidewalk 3 or 4 blocks beyond Puritan Square, and suddenly he could hear the sound of Sully John's bolo bouncer, whap, whap, whap. "If she's trash," S.J. had said, "I'd love to be the trash man." The poster they'd seen that day filled Bobby's mind. Brigitte Bardot, the French sex kitten, was what the papers called her, dressed only in a towel and a smile. She looked a little like the woman getting out of the car in one of the calendars back at the corner pocket, the one with most of her skirt in her lap and her garters showing. Brigitte Bardot was prettier, though. And she was real. She was too old for the likes of Bobby Garfield, of course. "I'm so young and you're so old," Paul Anka singing from 1,000 transistor radios. "This, my darling, I've been told." But she was still beautiful. And a cat could look at a queen. His mother always said that, too. A cat could look at a queen. Bobby saw her more and more clearly as he settled back against the seat, his eyes taking on that drifty, far-off look Ted's eyes got when he had one of his blankouts. Bobby saw her shower-damp puff of blonde hair, the slope of her breasts into the towel, her long thighs, her painted toenails standing over the words, "Adults only must have driver's license or birth certificate." He could smell her soap, something light and flowery. He could smell Nuit en Paris, her perfume, and he could hear her radio in the next room. It was Freddie Cannon, that bebop summertime avatar of Savin Rock. "She's dancing to the drag, the cha-cha ragamop. She's stomping to the shag, rocks the bunny hop." He was aware, faintly, far away, in another world, farther up along the swirls of the spinning top, that the cab in which they were riding had come to a stop right next to the William Penn Grill, right next to that purple bruise of a DeSoto. Bobby could almost hear the car in his head. If it had had a voice, it would have screamed, "Shoot me, I'm too purple, shoot me, I'm too purple," and not far beyond it, he could sense them. They were in the restaurant, having an early steak. Both of them ate it the same way, bloody rare. Before they left, they might put up a lost pet poster in the telephone lounge or a hand-printed car for sale by owner card upside down, of course. They were in there. Low men in yellow coats and white shoes drinking martinis between bites of nearly raw steer, and if they turned their minds out this way,
Steam was drifting out of the shower. Bibi raised herself on her bare painted toes and opened her towel, turning it into brief wings before letting it fall, and Bobby saw it wasn't Brigitte Bardot at all. It was Carol Gerber. You'd have to be brave to let people look at you with nothing on but a towel, she had said, and now she had let even the towel fall away. He was seeing her as she would look 8 or 10 years from now. Bobby looked at her, helpless to look away, helpless in love, lost in the smells of her soap and her perfume, the sound of her radio. Freddie Cannon had given way to the Platters. Heavenly shades of night are falling. The sight of her small painted toenails. His heart spun as a top did, with its lines rising and disappearing into other worlds than this. The taxi began creeping forward. The four-door purple horror parked next to the restaurant, parked in a loading zone, Bobby saw, but what did they care? Began to slide to the rear. The cab jolted to a stop again, and the driver cursed mildly as a trolley rushed clang-a-lang through Puritan Square. The Lo de Soto was behind them now, but reflections from its chrome filled the cab with erratic dancing minnows of light. And suddenly Bobby felt a savage itching attack the backs of his eyeballs. This was followed by a fall of twisting black threads across his field of vision. He was able to hold on to Carol, but he now seemed to be looking at her through a field of interference. They sense us, or they sense something. Please, God, get us out of here. Please get us out. The cabbie saw a hole in the traffic and squirted through it. A moment later, they were rolling up Asher Avenue at a good pace. That itching sensation behind Bobby's eyes began to recede. The black threads across his field of interior vision cleared away, and when they did, he saw that the naked girl wasn't Carol at all, not anymore at least, not even Brigitte Bardot, but only the calendar girl from the corner pocket, stripped, mother naked by Bobby's imagination. The music from her radio was gone. The smells of soap and perfume were gone. The life had gone out of her. She was just, she's just a picture painted on a brick wall, Bobby said. He sat up. Say what, kid? The driver asked and snapped off the radio. The game was over. Mel Allen was selling cigarettes. Nothing, Bobby said. Guess you dozed off, huh? Slow traffic, hot day. They'll do it every time, just like Havlo says. Looks like your pal's still out. No, Ted said, straightening. The doctor is in. He stretched his back and winced when it crackled. I did doze a little, though. He glanced out the back window, but the William Penn Grill was out of sight now. The Yankees won, I suppose.
Goddamn engines, they ruined them,
the cabbie said and laughed.
Don't see how yous could sleep with the Yankees playing.
They turned onto Broad Street. 2 minutes later, the cab pulled up in front of 149. Bobby looked at it as if expecting to see a different color paint or perhaps an added wing. He felt he'd been gone 10 years. In a way, he supposed he had been. Hadn't he seen Carol Gerber all grown up? I'm going to marry her, Bobby decided as he got out of the cab. Over on Colony Street, Mrs. O'Hara's dog barked on and on, as if denying this and all human aspirations. Roof, 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 roof. Ted bent down to the driver's side window with his wallet in his hand. He plucked out 2 singles, considered, then added a third. Keep the change.
You're a gent, the cabbie said.
He's a shooter, Bobby corrected, and grinned as the cab pulled away.
Let's get inside, Ted said. It's not safe for me to be out here.
They went up the porch steps, and Bobby used his key to open the door to the foyer. He kept thinking about that weird itching behind his eyes and the black threads. The threads had been particularly horrible, as if he'd been on the verge of going blind. Did they see us, Ted, or sense us, or whatever they do?
You know they did, but I don't think they knew how close we were.
As they went into the Garfield apartment, Ted took off his sunglasses and tucked them into his shirt pocket.
You must have covered up well.
Ooh, hot in here. What makes you think they didn't know we were close? Ted paused in the act of opening a window, giving Bobby a level look back over his shoulder.
If they'd known, that purple car would have been right behind us when we pulled up here.
It wasn't a car,
Bobby said, beginning to open windows himself. It didn't help much, the air that came in, lifting the curtains in listless little flaps, felt almost as hot as the air which had been trapped inside the apartment all day.
I don't know what it was, but it only looked like a car, and what I felt of them,
even in the heat. Bobby shivered. Ted got his fan, crossed to the window by Liz's shelf of knickknacks, and set it on the sill. They camouflage themselves as best they can, but we still feel them. Even people who don't know what they are often feel them. A little of what's under the camouflage seeps through, and what's underneath is ugly. I hope you never know how ugly. Bobby hoped so, too. Where do they come from, Ted?
A dark place.
Ted knelt, plugged in his fan, flipped it on. The air it pulled into the room was a little cooler, but not so cool as the corner pocket had been, or the Criterion. Is it in another world, like in Ring Around the Sun? It is, isn't it? Ted was still on his knees by the electrical plug. He looked as if he were praying. To Bobby, he also looked exhausted, done almost to death. How could he run from the low men? He didn't look as if he could make it as far as Spicer's Variety Store without stumbling. Yes, he said at last, they come from another world.
Another where and another when. That's all I can tell you. It's not safe for you to know more.
But Bobby had to ask one other question. Did you come from one of those other worlds?
Ted looked at him solemnly. I came from Teaneck.
Bobby gaped at him for a moment, then began to laugh. Ted, still kneeling by the fan, joined him. What did you think of in the cab, Bobby? Ted asked, when they were finally able to stop. Where did you go when the trouble started? He paused. What did you see? Bobby thought of Carol at 20 with her toenails painted pink. Carol standing naked with a towel at her feet and steam rising around her.
Adults only. Must have driver's license. No exceptions.
I can't tell, he said at last, because... Well...
Because some things are private. I understand.
Ted got to his feet. Bobby stepped forward to help him, but Ted waved him away.
Perhaps you'd like to go out and play for a little while, he said. Later on, around 6, shall we say, I'll put on my dark glasses again and we'll go around the block, have a bite of dinner at the Colony Diner.
But no beans. The corners of Ted's mouth twitched in the ghost of a smile.
Absolutely no beans. Beans? Verboten. At 10 o'clock, I'll call my friend Len and see how the fight went, eh?
The low men. Will they be looking for me now, too?
I'd never let you step out the door if I thought that, Ted replied, looking surprised. You're fine. And I'm going to make sure you stay fine. Go on now. Play some catch or ring Olivio or whatever it is you like. I have some things to do. Only be back by 6, so I don't worry.
Okay. Bobby went into his room and dumped the 4 quarters he'd taken to Bridgeport back into the bike fund jar. He looked around his room, seeing things with new eyes, the cowboy bedspread, the picture of his mother on one wall and the signed photo, obtained by saving cereal box stops, of Clayton Moore in his mask on another, his roller skates, one with a broken strap in the corner, his desk against the wall. The room looked smaller now. Not so much a place to come to as a place to leave. He realized he was growing into his orange library card, and some bitter voice inside cried out against it.
Cried, no, no, no.
8. Bobby makes a confession. The Gerber baby and the Maltex baby. Rianda. Ted makes a call. Cry of the hunters. In Commonwealth Park, the little kids were playing tiki ball. Field B was empty. On Field C, a few teenagers in orange St. Gabriel's t-shirts were playing scrub. Carol Gerber was sitting on a bench with her jump rope in her lap watching them. She saw Bobby coming and began to smile. Then the smile went away. Bobby, what's wrong with you? Bobby hadn't been precisely aware that anything was wrong with him until Carol said that, but the look of concern on her face brought everything home and undid him. It was the reality of the low men and the fright of the close call they'd had on their way back from Bridgeport. It was his concern over his mother. Mostly, it was Ted. He knew perfectly well why Ted had shooed him out of the house and what Ted was doing right now, filling his little suitcases in those carry-handle paper bags. His friend was going away. Bobby began to cry. He didn't want to go all ushy-gushy in front of a girl, particularly this girl, but he couldn't help it. Carol looked stunned for a moment, scared. Then she got off the bench, came to him, and put her arms around him. "That's all right," she said. "It's all right, Bobby. Don't cry. Everything's all right." Almost blinded by tears and crying harder than ever, it was as if there were a violent summer storm going on in his head. Bobby let her lead him into a copse of trees where they would be hidden from the baseball fields and the main paths. She sat down on the grass, still holding him, brushing one hand through the sweaty bristles of his crew cut. For a little while she said nothing at all, and Bobby was incapable of speaking. He could only sob until his throat ached and his eyeballs throbbed in their sockets. At last the intervals between sobs became longer. He sat up and wiped his face with his arm, horrified and ashamed of what he felt, not just tears but snot and spit as well. He must have covered her with mung. Carol didn't seem to care. She touched his wet face. Bobby pulled back from her fingers, uttering another sob, and looked down at the grass. His eyesight, freshly washed by his tears, seemed almost preternaturally keen. He could see every blade and dandelion. "It's all right," she said, but Bobby was still too ashamed to look at her. They sat quietly for a little while, and then Carol said, "Bobby, I'll be your girlfriend if you want." "You are my girlfriend," Bobby said. "Then tell me what's wrong." And Bobby heard himself telling her everything, starting with the day Ted had moved in and how his mother had taken an instant dislike to him. He told her about the first of Ted's blankouts, about the low men, about the signs of the low men. When he got to that part, Carol touched him on the arm. "What?" he asked. "You don't believe me?" His throat still had that achy, too-full feeling it got after a crying fit, but he was getting better. If she didn't believe him, he wouldn't be mad at her, wouldn't blame her a bit. In fact, it was just an enormous relief to get it off his chest. "That's okay. I know how crazy it must. I've seen those funny hopscotches all over town," she said. "So has Yvonne and Angie. We talked about them. They have little stars and moons drawn next to them, sometimes comets, too." He gaped at her. "Are you kidding?" "No. Girls always look at hopscotches. I don't know why." "Close your mouth before a bug flies in." He closed his mouth. Carol nodded, satisfied, then took his hand in hers and laced her fingers through his. Bobby was amazed at what a perfect fit all those fingers made. "Now tell me the rest." He did, finishing with the amazing day he'd just put in, the movie The Trip to the Corner Pocket, how Alana had recognized his father in him, the close call on the way home. He tried to explain how the purple DeSoto hadn't seemed like a real car at all, that it only looked like a car. The closest he could come was to say it had felt alive somehow, like an evil version of the ostrich Dr. Doolittle sometimes wrote in that series of talking animal books they'd all gone crazy for in the second grade. The only thing Bobby didn't confess was where he'd hidden his thoughts when the cab passed the William Penn Grill and the backs of his eyes began to itch.
He struggled, then blurted the worst, as a coda. He was afraid that his mother going to Providence with Mr. Biderman and those other men had been a mistake. A bad mistake. "Do you think Mr. Biderman's sweet on her?" Carol asked. By then they were walking back to the bench where she had left her jump rope. Bobby picked it up and handed it to her. They began walking out of the park and toward Broad Street. "Yeah, maybe," Bobby said glumly. "Or at least..." And here was part of what he was afraid of. Although it had no name or real shape, it was like something ominous covered with a piece of canvas. "At least she thinks he is. Is he going to ask her to marry him? If he did, he'd be your stepdad." God! Bobby hadn't considered the idea of having Don Biderman as a stepfather, and he wished with all his might that Carol hadn't brought such a thing up. It was an awful thought. "If she loves him, you just better get used to the idea," Carol spoke in an older woman, worldly wise fashion that Bobby could have done without. He guessed she had already spent too much time this summer watching the old John O'Marsha shows on TV with her mom. And in a weird way, he wouldn't have cared if his mom loved Mr. Biderman, and that was all. It would be wretched, certainly, because Mr. Biderman was a creep. But it would have been understandable. More was going on, though. His mother's miserliness about money or cheapskatiness was a part of it, and so was whatever had made her start smoking again and caused her to cry in the night sometimes. The difference between his mother's Randall Garfield, the untrustworthy man who left the unpaid bills, and Alanis Randy Garfield, the nice guy who liked the jukebox turned up loud, even that might be a part of it. Had there really been unpaid bills? Had there really been a lapsed insurance policy? Why would his mother lie about such things? This was stuff he couldn't talk about to Carol. It wasn't reticence. It was that he didn't know how. They started up the hill. Bobby took one end of her rope, and they walked side by side, dragging it between them on the sidewalk. Suddenly, Bobby stopped and pointed. Look. There was a yellow length of kite tail hanging from one of the electrical wires crossing the street farther up. It dangled in a curve that looked sort of like a question mark.
Yeah, I see it, Carol said, sounding subdued. They began to walk again.
He should go today, Bobby.
He can't. The fight's tonight if Albini wins. Ted's got to get his dough at the billiard parlor tomorrow night. I think he needs it pretty bad.
Sure he does, Carol said. You only have to look at his clothes to see he's almost broke.
What he bet was probably the last money he had. His clothes, that's something only a girl would notice, Bobby thought, and opened his mouth to tell her so. Before he could, someone behind them said, "Oh, look at this. It's the Gerber baby and the Maltex baby. How you doing, babies?"
They looked around. Biking slowly up the hill toward them were three St. Gabe's boys in orange shirts. Piled in their bike baskets was an assortment of baseball gear. One of the boys, a pimply galoot with a silver cross dangling from his neck on a chain, had a baseball bat in a homemade sling on his back. Thinks he's Robin Hood, Bobby thought, but he was scared. They were big boys, high school boys, parochial school boys, and if they decided they wanted to put him in the hospital, then to the hospital he would go. Low boys in orange shirts, he thought.
"Hi, Willie," Carol said to one of them.
Not the galoot with the bat slung on his back. She sounded calm, even cheery, but Bobby could hear fright fluttering underneath like a bird's wing.
"I watched you play. You made a good catch."
The one she spoke to had an ugly, half-formed face below a mass of combed-back auburn hair and above a man's body. The huffy bike beneath him was ridiculously small. Bobby thought he looked like a troll in a fairy tale.
"What's it to you, Gerber baby?" he asked.
The three St. Gabe's boys pulled up even with them, then two of them, the one with the dangling cross and the one Carol had called Willie, came a little farther, standing around the forks of their bikes, now walking them. With mounting dismay, Bobby realized he and Carol had been surrounded. He could smell a mixture of sweat and Vitalis coming from the boys in the orange shirts.
"Who are you, Maltex baby?" The third, St. Gabe's boy, asked Bobby. He leaned over the handlebars of his bike for a better look.
Are you Garfield? You are, ain't you? Billy Donahue's still looking for you from that time last winter. He wants to knock your teeth out. Maybe I ought to knock one or two of them out right here, give him a head start.
Bobby felt a wretched crawling sensation begin in his stomach, something like snakes in a basket. I won't cry again, he told himself. Whatever happens, I won't cry again, even if they send me to the hospital, and I'll try to protect her. Protect her? From big kids like this, it was a joke. Why are you being so mean, Willie? Carol asked. She spoke solely to the boy with the auburn hair. You're not mean when you're by yourself. Why do you have to be mean now? Willie flushed. That, coupled with his dark red hair, much darker than Bobby's, made him look on fire from the neck up. Bobby guessed he didn't like his friends knowing he could act like a human being when they weren't around.
Shut up, Gerber baby, he snarled. Why don't you just shut up and kiss your boyfriend while he's still got all his teeth?
The third boy was wearing a motorcycle belt cinched on the side and ancient snapjack shoes covered with dirt from the baseball field. He was behind Carol. Now he moved in closer, still walking his bike, and grabbed her ponytail with both hands. He pulled it.
Ow!
Carol almost screamed. She sounded surprised as well as hurt. She pulled away so hard that she almost fell down. Bobby caught her, and Willie, who could be nice when he wasn't with his pals, according to Carol, laughed.
Why'd you do that?
Bobby yelled at the boy in the motorcycle belt, and as the words came out of his mouth, it was as if he'd heard them 1,000 times before. All of this was like a ritual, the stuff that got said before the real yanks and pushes began and the fists began to fly. He thought of Lord of the Flies again, Ralph, running from Jack and the others. At least on Golding's Island there'd been a jungle. He and Carol had nowhere to run. He says, because I felt like it, that's what comes next. But before the boy with the side-cinched belt could say it, Robin Hood, with the homemade bat sling on his back, said it for him.
Because he felt like it. What you gonna do about it, Maltex baby?
He suddenly flicked out one hand, snake quick, and slapped Bobby across the face. Willie laughed again. Carol started toward him.
Willie, please don't.
Robin Hood reached out, grabbed the front of Carol's shirt, and squeezed. Got any titties yet?
Nah, not much. You ain't nothing but a Gerber baby.
He pushed her. Bobby, his head still ringing from the slap, caught her, and for the second time kept her from falling down.
Let's beat this queer up, the kid on the motorcycle belt said. I hate his face.
They moved in, the wheels of their bikes squeaking solemnly. Then Willie let his drop on his side like a dead pony and reached for Bobby. Bobby raised his fists in a feeble imitation of Floyd Patterson.
Say, boys, what's going on?
Someone asked from behind them. Willie had drawn one of his own fists back, still holding it, cocked. He looked over his shoulder. So did Robin Hood and the boy with the motorcycle belt. Parked at the curb was an old blue Studebaker with rusty rocker panels and a magnetic Jesus on the dashboard. Standing in front of it, looking extremely busty in the chest and extremely wide in the hip, was Anita Gerber's friend, Rhianda. Summer clothes were never going to be her friends, even at 11, Bobby understood this, but at that moment she looked like a goddess in petal pushers.
Rhianda!
Carol yelled, not crying, but almost. She pushed past Willie and the boy in the motorcycle belt. Neither made any effort to stop her. All three of the St. Gabe's boys were staring at Rhianda. Bobby found himself looking at Willie's cocked fist. Sometimes Bobby woke up in the morning with his Peter just as hard as a rock, standing straight up like a moon rocket or something. As he went into the bathroom to pee, it would soften and wilt. Willie's cocked arm was wilting like that now, the fist at the end of it relaxing back into fingers, and the comparison made Bobby want to smile. He resisted the urge. If they saw him smiling now, they could do nothing. Later, however, on another day, Rhianda put her arms around Carol and hugged the girl to her large bosom. She surveyed the boys in the orange shirts, and she was smiling, smiling and making no effort to hide it.
Willie Sherman, isn't it?
The formerly cocked-back arm dropped to Willie's side. Muttering, he bent to pick up his bike.
Richie O'Meara?
The boy in the motorcycle belt looked at the toes of his dusty snapjacks and also muttered something. His cheeks burned with color. One of the O'Meara boys, anyway, that so damn many of you know I can't keep track. Her eyes shifted to Robin Hood. And who are you, big boy? Are you a Dedham? You look a little bit like a Dedham.
Robin Hood looked at his hands. He wore a class ring on one of his fingers, and now he began to twist it. Rhianda still had an arm around Carol's shoulders. Carol had one of her own arms, as far around Rhianda's waist as she could manage. She walked with Rhianda, not looking at the boys, as Rhianda stepped up from the street onto the little strip of grass between the curb and the sidewalk. She was still looking at Robin Hood.
You better answer me when I talk to you, sonny. Won't be hard to find your mother if I want to try. All I have to do is ask Father Fitzgerald.
Harry Doolin, that's me, the boy said at last. He was twirling his class ring faster than ever.
Well, but I was close, wasn't I?
Rhianda asked pleasantly, taking another two or three steps forward. They put her on the sidewalk. Carol, afraid to be so close to the boys, tried to hold her back, but Rhianda would have none of it.
Dedhams and Doolins, all married together, right back to County Cork, tra-la-tra-lee.
Not Robin Hood, but a kid named Harry Doolin, with a stupid homemade bat sling strapped to his back. Not Marlon Brando from The Wild One, but a kid named Richie O'Meara, who wouldn't have a Harley to go with his motorcycle belt for another 5 years, if ever, and Willie Shearman, who didn't dare to be nice to a girl when he was with his friends. All it took to shrink them back to their proper size was one overweight woman in pedal pushers and a shell top, who had ridden to the rescue not on a white stallion but in a 1954 Studebaker. The thought should have comforted Bobby, but it didn't. He found himself thinking of what William Golding had said, that the boys on the island were rescued by the crew of a battle cruiser, and good for them. But who would rescue the crew? That was stupid. No one ever looked less in need of rescuing than Rhianda Hewson did at that moment, but the words still haunted Bobby. What if there were no grown-ups? Suppose the whole idea of grown-ups was an illusion. What if their money was really just playground marbles, their business deals no more than baseball card trades, their wars only games of guns in the park? What if they were all still snotty-nosed kids inside their suits and dresses? Christ, that couldn't be, could it? It was too horrible to think about. Rhianda was still looking at the St. Gabe's boys with her hard and rather dangerous smile. You three fellows wouldn't have been picking on kids younger and smaller than yourselves, would you? One of them a girl, like your own little sisters? They were silent, not even muttering now. They only shuffled their feet. I'm sure you weren't, because that would be a cowardly thing to do now, wouldn't it? Again she gave them a chance to reply, and plenty of time to hear their own silence. Willie? Richie? Harry, you weren't picking on them, were you? Of course not, Harry said. Bobby thought that if he spun that ring of his much faster, his finger would probably catch fire.
If I thought a thing like that, Rhianda said, still smiling her dangerous smile, I'd have to go talk to Father Fitzgerald, wouldn't I? And the father, he'd probably feel he had to talk to your folks. And your fathers probably feel obliged to warm your asses for you, and you deserve it, boys, wouldn't you, for picking on the weak and small?
Continued silence from the three boys, all now astride their ridiculously undersized bikes again.
Did they pick on you, Bobby?
Rhianda asked.
Nope,
Bobby said at once. Rhianda put a finger under Carol's chin and turned her face up. Did they pick on you, Lovey? No, Rhianda. Rhianda smiled down at her, and although there were tears standing in Carol's eyes, she smiled back.
"Well, boys, I guess you're off the hook," Rhianda said. "They say you haven't done nothing that'll cause you a single extra uncomfy minute in the confessional. I'd say you owe them a vote of thanks, don't you?"
Mutter, mutter, mutter from the St. Gabe's boys. "Please let it go at that," Bobby pleaded silently. "Don't make them actually thank us. Don't rub their noses in it." Perhaps Rhianda heard his thought. Bobby now had good reason to believe such things were possible. "Well," she said, "maybe we can skip that part. Get along home, boys,
And, Harry, when you see Moira Dedham, tell her Rhianda says she still goes to the Bingo over in Bridgeport every week if she ever wants a ride. Well, sure, Harry said. He mounted his bike and rode away up the hill, eyes still on the sidewalk. Had there been pedestrians coming the other way, he would likely have run them over. His two friends followed him, standing on their pedals to catch up. Rhianda watched them go, her smile slowly fading. Shanty Irish, she said at last, just trouble waiting to happen. Bah, good riddance to him. Carol, are you really all right? Carol said she really was. Bobby? Sure, I'm fine. It was taking him all the discipline he could manage not to start shaking right in front of her like a bowl of cranberry jelly. But if Carol could keep from falling apart, he guessed he could. Get in the car, Rhianda said to Carol. I'll give you a lift up to your house. You move along yourself, Bobby. Scoot across the street and go inside. Those boys will have forgotten all about you and my Carol girl by tomorrow, but tonight it might be smart for both of you to stay inside. Okay, Bobby said, knowing they wouldn't have forgotten by tomorrow, nor by the end of the week, nor by the end of the summer. He and Carol were going to have to watch out for Harry and his friends for a long time. Bye, Carol. Bye. Bobby trotted across Broad Street. On the other side, he stood watching Rhianda's old car go up to the apartment house where the Gerbers lived. When Carol got out, she looked back down the hill and waved. Bobby waved back, then walked up the porch steps of 149 and went inside. Ted was sitting in the living room, smoking a cigarette and reading Life magazine. Anita Ekberg was on the cover. Bobby had no doubt that Ted's suitcases and the paper bags were packed, but there was no sign of them. He must have left them upstairs in his room. Bobby was glad. He didn't want to look at them. It was bad enough just knowing they were there.
What did you do? Ted asked.
Not much, Bobby said. I think I'll lie down on my bed and read until supper. He went into his room. Stacked on the floor by his bed were three books from the adult section of the Harwich Public Library. Cosmic Engineers by Clifford D. Simak, The Roman Hat Mystery by Ellery Queen, and The Inheritors by William Golding. Bobby chose The Inheritors and lay down with his head at the foot of his bed and his stocking feet on his pillow. There were cave people on the book's cover, but they were drawn in a way that was almost abstract. You'd never see cave people like that on the cover of a kid's book. Having an adult library card was very neat, but somehow not as neat as it had seemed at first. Hawaiian Eye was on at 9 o'clock, and Bobby ordinarily would have been mesmerized. His mother claimed that shows like Hawaiian Eye and The Untouchables were too violent for children and ordinarily would not let him watch them. But tonight his mind kept wandering from the story. Less than 60 miles from here, Eddie Albini and Hurricane Haywood would be mixing it up. The Gillette Blue Blades girl, dressed in a blue bathing suit and blue high heels, would be parading around the ring before the start of every round and holding up a sign with a blue number on it. 1, 2, 3, 4. By 9:30, Bobby couldn't have picked out the private eye on the TV show, let alone guessed who had murdered the blonde socialite. Hurricane Haywood goes down in the 8th round, Ted had told him. Old Gene knew it, but what if something went wrong? He didn't want Ted to go, but if he had to, Bobby couldn't bear the thought of him going with an empty wallet. Surely that couldn't happen, though, or could it? Bobby had seen a TV show where a fighter was supposed to take a dive and then changed his mind. What if that happened tonight? Taking a dive was bad. It was cheating. No shit, Sherlock. What was your first clue? But if Hurricane Haywood didn't cheat, Ted would be in a lot of trouble. Hurtin' for certain was how Sully John would have put it. 9:30, according to the sunburst clock in the living room wall. If Bobby's math was right, the crucial 8th round was now underway.
How do you like The Inheritors?
Bobby was so deep into his own thoughts that Ted's voice made him jump. On TV, Keenan Wynn was standing in front of a bulldozer and saying he'd walk a mile for a camel.
It's a lot harder than Lord of the Flies, he said. It seems like there are these two little families of cave people wandering around, and one family is smarter. But the other family, the dumb family, they're the heroes. I almost gave up, but now it's getting more interesting. I guess I'll stick with it.
The family you meet first, the one with the little girl, they're Neanderthals. The second family, only that one's really a tribe, Golding and his tribes, are Cro-Magnons. The Cro-Magnons are the inheritors. What happens between the two groups satisfies the definition of tragedy. Events tending toward an unhappy outcome, which cannot be avoided. Ted went on, talking about plays by Shakespeare, and poems by Poe, and novels by a guy named Theodore Dreiser. Ordinarily, Bobby would have been interested. But tonight his mind kept going to Madison Square Garden. He could see the ring, lit as savagely as the few working pool tables in the corner pocket had been. He could hear the crowd screaming as Haywood poured it on, smacking the surprised Eddie Albini with lefts and rights. Haywood wasn't going to tank the fight. Like the boxer in the TV show, he was going to show the other guy a serious world of hurt instead. Bobby could smell sweat and hear the heavy biff, baff of gloves on flesh. Eddie Albini's eyes came up double zeros. His knees buckled. The crowd was on its feet, screaming. The idea of fate as a force which can't be escaped seems to start with the Greeks. There was a playwright named Euripides who... Call, Bobby said. And although he'd never had a cigarette in his life, by 1964 he would be smoking over a carton a week, his voice sounded as harsh as Ted's did late at night after a day's worth of Chesterfields. Beg your pardon, Bobby.
Call Mr. Files and see about the fight.
Bobby looked at the sunburst clock. 9:49.
If it only went 8, it'll be over now.
I agree that the fight is over, but if I call Files so soon, he may suspect I knew something, Ted said. Not from the radio, either. This one isn't on the radio, as we both know. It's better to wait. Safer. Let him believe I am a man of inspired hunches. I'll call at 10, as if I expected the result to be a decision instead of a knockout. And in the meantime, Bobby, don't worry. I tell you, it's a stroll on the boardwalk.
Bobby gave up trying to follow Hawaiian Eye at all. He just sat on the couch and listened to the actors quack. A man shouted at a fat Hawaiian cop. A woman in a white bathing suit ran into the surf. One car chased another while drums throbbed on the soundtrack. The hands of the sunburst clock crawled, struggling toward the 10 and the 12 like climbers negotiating the last few hundred feet of Mount Everest. The man who'd murdered the socialite was killed himself as he ran around in a pineapple field in Hawaiian Eye. Finally ended. Bobby didn't wait for the previews of next week's show. He snapped off the TV and said, call, okay, please call.
In a moment, Ted said. I think I went one root beer over my limit. My holding tank seemed to have shrunk with age.
He shuffled into the bathroom. There was an interminable pause, and then the sound of pee splashing into the bowl.
Ah, Ted said.
There was considerable satisfaction in his voice. Bobby could no longer sit. He got up and began pacing around the living room. He was sure that Tommy Hurricane Haywood was right now being photographed in his corner at the garden, bruised but beaming as the flashbulb splashed white light over his face. The Gillette Blue Blades girl would be there with him, her arm around his shoulders, his hand around her waist, as Eddie Albini slumped forgotten in his own corner. Dazed eyes puffed almost shut, still not completely conscious from the pounding he had taken. By the time Ted returned, Bobby was in despair. He knew that Albini had lost the fight and his friend had lost his $500. Would Ted stay when he found out he was broke? He might, but if he did, and the low men came... Bobby watched, fists clenching and unclenching as Ted picked up the telephone and dialed.
Relax, Bobby,
Ted told him. It's going to be okay. But Bobby couldn't relax. His guts felt full of wires. Ted held the phone to his ear without saying anything for what seemed like forever.
Why don't they answer?
Bobby whispered fiercely.
It's only rung twice, Bobby.
Why don't you...
Hello? This is Mr. Brodigan calling. Ted Brodigan? Yes, ma'am, from this afternoon.
Incredibly, Ted tipped Bobby a wink. How could he be so cool? Bobby didn't think he himself would have been capable of holding the phone up to his ear if he'd been in Ted's position, let alone winking.
Yes, ma'am, he is.
Ted turned to Bobby and said without covering the mouthpiece of the phone, Alana wants to know how is your girlfriend. Bobby tried to speak and could only wheeze.
Bobby says she's fine, Ted told Alana, pretty as a summer day. May I speak to Len? Yes, I can wait. But please tell me about the fight.
There was a pause, which seemed to go on forever. Ted was expressionless now. And this time, when he turned to Bobby, he covered the mouthpiece.
She says, Albini got knocked around pretty good in the first five, held his own in six and seven, then threw a right hook out of nowhere and put Haywood on the canvas in the eighth. Lights out for the Hurricane.
What a surprise, huh?
Yes, Bobby said. His lips felt numb. It was true, all of it.
By this time Friday night, Ted would be gone. With 2,000 rocks in your pocket, you could do a lot of running from a lot of low men. With 2,000 rocks in your pocket, you could ride the big gray dog from sea to shining sea. Bobby went into the bathroom and squirted Ipana on his toothbrush. His terror that Ted had bet on the wrong fighter was gone. But the sadness of approaching loss was still there, and still growing. He never would have guessed that something that hadn't even happened could hurt so much. A week from now, I won't remember what was so neat about him. A year from now, I'll hardly remember him at all.
Was that true? God, was that true?
No, Bobby thought, no way, I won't let it be.
In the other room, Ted was conversing with Len Files. It seemed to be a friendly enough palaver, going just as Ted had expected it would. And yes, here was Ted saying he'd just played a hunch. A good, strong one, the kind you had to bet if you wanted to think of yourself as a sport. Sure, 9:30 tomorrow night would be fine for the payout, assuming his friend's mother was back by 8. If she was a little late, Len would seem around 10 or 10:30. Did that suit? More laughter from Ted, so it seemed that it suited fat Lenny Files right down to the ground.
Bobby put his toothbrush back in the glass on the shelf below the mirror, then reached into his pants pocket. There was something in there his fingers didn't recognize, not a part of the usual pocket litter. He pulled out the keyring with the green fob, his special souvenir of a part of Bridgeport his mother knew nothing about, the part that was down there. The corner pocket, billiards, pool, auto games, Kenmore, 82127. He probably should have hidden it already, or gotten rid of it entirely, and suddenly an idea came to him. Nothing could have really cheered Bobby Garfield up that night, but this at least came close. He would give the key ring to Carol Gerber, after cautioning her never to tell his mom where she'd gotten it. He knew that Carol had at least two keys she could put on it, her apartment key and the key to the diary Rihanna had given her for her birthday. Carol was 3 months older than Bobby, but she never lorded it over him on this account. Giving her the key ring would be a little like asking her to go steady. He wouldn't have to get all gushy and embarrass himself by saying so either. Carol would know. It was part of what made her cool. Bobby laid the key ring on the shelf next to the tooth glass, then went into his bedroom to put on his PJs. When he came out, Ted was sitting on the couch, smoking a cigarette, and looking at him.
Bobby, are you all right?
I guess so. I guess I have to be, don't I?
Ted nodded. I guess we both have to be.
Will I ever see you again? Bobby asked, pleading in his mind for Ted not to sound like the Lone Ranger.
Not to start talking any of that corny "we'll meet again" pard stuff, because it wasn't stuff. That word was too kind. Shit was what it was. He didn't think Ted had ever lied to him, and he didn't want him to start now that they were near the end.
I don't know.
Ted studied the coal of his cigarette, and when he looked up, Bobby saw that his eyes were swimming with tears. I don't think so. Those tears undid Bobby. He ran across the room, wanting to hug Ted, needing to hug him. He stopped when Ted lifted his arms and crossed them over the chest of his baggy old man's shirt, his expression a kind of horrified surprise. Bobby stood where he was, his arms still held out to hug. Slowly he lowered them. No hugging, no touching. It was the rule. But the rule was mean. The rule was wrong. "Will you write?" he asked.
"I will send you postcards," Ted replied after a moment's thought. "Not directly to you, though. That might be dangerous for both of us. What shall I do?" "Any ideas?"
"Send them to Carol," Bobby said. He didn't even stop to think.
"When did you tell her about the low men, Bobby?"
There was no reproach in Ted's voice. Why would there be? He was going, wasn't he? For all the difference it made, the guy who did the story on the shopping cart thief could write it up for the paper. Crazy old man runs from invading aliens. People would read it to each other over their coffee and breakfast cereal and laugh. What had Ted called it that day? Galumphing, small-town humor. Hadn't that been it? But if it was so funny, why did it hurt? Why did it hurt so much? "Today," he said in a small voice, "I saw her in the park and everything just kind of came out."
"That can happen," Ted said gravely. "I know it well. Sometimes the dam just bursts. And perhaps it's for the best. You'll tell her I may want to get in touch with you through her?"
"Yeah."
Ted tapped a finger against his lips, thinking. Then he nodded. "At the top, the cards I send will say, 'Dear C,' instead of 'Dear Carol.' At the bottom, I'll sign, 'A friend.' That way, you'll both know who writes. Okay?"
"Yeah," Bobby said, "cool." It wasn't cool. None of this was cool. But it would do. He suddenly lifted his hand, kissed his fingers, and blew across them. Ted, sitting on the couch, smiled, caught the kiss, and put it on his lined cheek.
"You better go to bed now, Bobby. It's been a big day and it's late." Bobby went to bed. At first he thought it was the same dream as before. Biderman, Cushman, and Dean chasing his mom through the jungle of William Golding's island. Then Bobby realized the trees and vines were part of the wallpaper, and that the path under his mother's flying feet was brown carpet, not a jungle, but a hotel corridor. This was his mind's version of the Warwick Hotel. Mr. Biderman and the other two Nimrods were still chasing her, though. And now, so were the boys from St. Gabe's, Willie and Richie and Harry Doolin. All of them were wearing those streaks of red and white paint on their faces. And all of them were wearing bright yellow doublets, upon which was drawn a brilliant red eye. Other than the doublets, they were naked. Their privates flapped and bobbed in bushy nests of pubic hair. All save Harry Doolin brandished spears. He had his baseball bat. It had been sharpened to a point on both ends. "Kill the bitch!" Cushman yelled. "Drink her blood!" Don Biderman cried and threw his spear at Liz Garfield as she darted around a corner. The spear stuck, quivering, into one of the jungle-painted walls. "Stick it up her dirty cunt!" cried Willie. Willie, who could be nice when he wasn't with his friends. The red eye on his chest stared. Below it, his penis also seemed to stare. "Run, Mom!"
Bobby tried to scream, but no words came out. He had no mouth, no body. He was here, and yet he wasn't. He flew beside his mother like her own shadow. He heard her gasping for breath, saw her trembling, terrified mouth and her torn stockings. Her fancy dress was also torn. One of her breasts was scratched and bleeding. One of her eyes was almost closed. She looked as if she'd gone a few rounds with Eddie Albini or Hurricane Haywood, maybe both at the same time. "Gonna split you open!" Richie hollered. "Eat you alive!" agreed Curtis Dean in a top volume. "Drink your blood! Strew your guts!" His mom looked back at them and her feet, she had lost her shoes somewhere, stuttered against each other. "Don't do that, Mom," Bobby moaned. "For cripes sake, don't do that." And as if she'd heard him, Liz faced forward again and tried to run faster. She passed a poster on the wall. "Please help us find our pet pig. Liz is our mascot. Liz is 34 years old. She is a bad-tempered sow, but we love her. We'll do what you want if you say, 'I promise,' or 'There's money in it. Call Housatonic 58337, or bring to the William Penn Grill. Ask for the low men in the yellow coats. Motto, we eat it rare.'" His mom saw the poster, too, and this time when her ankles banged together, she did fall. "Get up, Mom!" Bobby screamed, but she didn't, perhaps couldn't. She crawled along the brown carpet, instead looking over her shoulder as she went, her hair hanging across her cheeks and forehead in sweaty clumps. The back of her dress had been torn away, and Bobby could see her bare bum. Her underpants were gone. Worse, the backs of her thighs were splashed with blood. What had they done to her? Dear God, what had they done to his mother? Don Biderman came around the corner ahead of her. He had found a shortcut and cut her off. The others were right behind him. Now Mr. Biderman's prick was standing straight up the way Bobby sometimes did in the morning before he got out of bed and went to the bathroom. Only Mr. Biderman's prick was huge. It looked like a kraken, a triffid, a monster. And Bobby thought he understood the blood on his mother's legs. He didn't want to, but he thought he did. "Leave her alone!" he tried to scream at Mr. Biderman. "Leave her alone! Haven't you done enough?" The scarlet eye on Mr. Biderman's yellow doublet suddenly opened wider and slithered to one side. Bobby was invisible, his body one world farther down the spinning top from this one. But the red eye saw him. The red eye saw everything. "Kill the pig! Drink her blood!" Mr. Biderman said in a thick, almost unrecognizable voice, and started forward. "Kill the pig! Drink her blood!" Bill Cushman and Curtis Dean chimed in. "Kill the pig! Strew her guts! Eat her flesh!" chanted Willie and Richie, falling in behind the Nimrods. Like those of the men, their pricks had turned into spears. "Eat her! Drink her! Strew her! Screw her!" Harry chimed in. "Get up, Mom! Run! Don't let them!" She tried. But even as she struggled from her knees to her feet, Biderman leaped at her. The others followed, closing in, and as their hands began to tear the tatters of her clothes from her body, Bobby thought, "I want to get out of here. I want to go back down the top to my own world, make it stop and spin it the other way so I can go back down to my own room in my own world." Except it wasn't a top. And even as the images of the dream began to break up and go dark, Bobby knew it. It wasn't a top, but a tower, a still spindle upon which all of existence moved and spun. Then it was gone, and for a little while there was a merciful nothingness. When he opened his eyes, his bedroom was full of sunshine. Summer sunshine on a Thursday morning in the last June of the Eisenhower presidency. Ugly Thursday. One thing you could say about Ted Brodigan, he knew how to cook. The breakfast he slid in front of Bobby, lightly scrambled eggs, toast, crisp bacon, was a lot better than anything his mother ever made for breakfast. Her specialty was huge, tasteless pancakes, which the two of them drowned in Aunt Jemima's syrup, and as good as anything you could get at the Colony Diner or the Harwich. The only problem was that Bobby didn't feel like eating.
He couldn't remember the details of his dream, but he knew it had been a nightmare, and that he must have cried at some point while it was going on. When he woke up, his pillow had been damp. Yet the dream wasn't the only reason he felt flat and depressed this morning. Dreams, after all, weren't real. Ted's going away would be real, and would be forever. "Are you leaving right from the corner pocket?" Bobby asked as Ted sat down across from him with his own plate of eggs and bacon. "You are, aren't you?" "Yes, that will be safest." He began to eat, but slowly and with no apparent enjoyment. So he was feeling bad, too. Bobby was glad. "I'll say to your mother that my brother in Illinois is ill. That's all she needs to know." "You gonna take the big gray dog?" Ted smiled briefly. "Probably the train. I'm quite the wealthy man, remember." "Which train?" "It's better if you don't know the details, Bobby. What you don't know, you can't tell. Or be made to tell." Bobby considered this briefly, then asked, "You'll remember the postcards?" Ted picked up a piece of bacon and put it down again. "Postcards. Plenty of postcards, I promise. Now don't let's talk about it anymore." "What should we talk about then?" Ted thought about it, then smiled. His smile was sweet and open. When he smiled, Bobby could see what he must have looked like when he was 20 and strong. "Books, of course," Ted said. "We'll talk about books." It was going to be a crushingly hot day. That was clear by 9 o'clock. Bobby helped with the dishes, drying and putting away, and then they sat in the living room where Ted's fan did its best to circulate the already tired air, and they talked about books. Or rather, Ted talked about books. And this morning, without the distraction of the Albini-Haywood fight, Bobby listened hungrily. He didn't understand all of what Ted was saying, but he understood enough to realize that books made their own world, and that the Harwich Public Library wasn't it. The library was nothing but the doorway to that world. Ted talked of William Golding and what he called dystopian fantasy, went on to H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, suggesting a link between the Morlocks and the Eloi and Jack and Ralph on Golding's Island. He talked about what he called literature's only excuses, which he said were exploring the questions of innocence and experience, good and evil. Near the end of this impromptu lecture, he mentioned a novel called The Exorcist, which dealt with both these questions in the popular context, and then stopped abruptly. He shook his head as if to clear it. "What's wrong?" Bobby took a sip of his root beer. He still didn't like it much, but it was the only soft drink in the fridge. Besides, it was cold. "What am I thinking?" Ted passed a hand over his brow as if he'd suddenly developed a headache. "That one hasn't been written yet."
"What do you mean?"
"Nothing. I'm rambling. Why don't you go out for a while? Stretch your legs. I might lie down for a bit. I didn't sleep very well last night."
"Okay."
Bobby guessed a little fresh air, even if it was hot fresh air, might do him good. And while it was interesting to listen to Ted talk, he had started to feel as if the apartment walls were closing in on him. It was knowing Ted was going, Bobby supposed. Now there was a sad little rhyme for you. Knowing he was going. For a moment, as he went back into his room to get his baseball glove, the keyring from the corner pocket crossed his mind. He was going to give it to Carol so she'd know they were going steady. Then he remembered Harry Doolin, Richie O'Meara, and Willie Shearman. They were out there someplace. Sure they were. And if they caught him by himself, they'd probably beat the crap out of him. For the first time in 2 or 3 days, Bobby found himself wishing for Sully. Sully was a little kid like him, but he was tough. Doolin and his friends might beat him up, but Sully John would make them pay for the privilege. SJ was at camp, though, and that was that. Bobby never considered staying in.
He couldn't hide all summer from the likes of Willie Shearman. That would be buggy. But as he went outside, he reminded himself that he had to be careful, had to be on the lookout for them. As long as he saw them coming, there would be no problem. With the St. Gabe's boys on his mind, Bobby left 149 with no further thought of the key fob, his special souvenir of down there. It lay on the bathroom shelf, next to the tooth glass, right where he had left it the night before. He tramped all over Harwich, it seemed, from Broad Street to Commonwealth Park. No St. Gabe's boys on field C today. The American Legion team was there taking batting practice and shagging flies in the hot sun. From the park to the town square, from the town square to the railway station. As he stood in the little newsstand kiosk beneath the railway overpass looking at paperbacks, Mr. Burton, who ran the place, would let you look for a while as long as you didn't handle what he called the merchandise. The town whistle went off, startling them both. "Mother of God, what's up with that?" Mr. Burton asked indignantly. He had spilled packs of gum all over the floor and now stooped to pick them up, his gray change apron hanging down. "It ain't but 11:15. "It's early, all right," Bobby agreed, and left the newsstand soon after. Browsing had lost its charms for him. He walked out to River Avenue, stopping at the Tip Top Bakery to buy half a loaf of day-old bread, 2 cents, and to ask Georgie Sullivan how S.J. was. "He's fine," S.J.'s oldest brother said. "We got a postcard on Tuesday, said he misses the family and wants to come home. We get one Wednesday, says he's learning how to dive. The one this morning, says he's having the time of his life, he wants to stay forever." He laughed, a big Irish boy of 20 with big Irish arms and shoulders. "He may want to stay forever, but Ma'd miss him like hell if he stayed up there. You gonna feed the ducks with some of that?"
"Yeah, like always."
"Don't let them nibble your fingers, those damn river ducks. Carry diseases, they—"
In the town square, the municipal building clock began to chime noon. Although it was still only 12:15.
"What's going on today?" Georgie asked. "First the whistle blows early, now the damn town clock's off course."
"Maybe it's the heat," Bobby said.
He looked at Bobby doubtfully. "Well, that's a good explanation as any."
Yeah, Bobby thought, going out, and quite a bit safer than some. Bobby went down to River Avenue, munching his bread as he walked. By the time he found a bench near the Housatonic River, most of the half-loaf had disappeared down his own throat. Ducks came waddling eagerly out of the reeds, and Bobby began to scatter the remaining bread for them, amused, as always, by the greedy way they ran for the chunks and the way they threw their heads back to eat them. After a while, he began to grow drowsy. He looked out, over the river, at the nets of reflected light shimmering on its surface, and grew drowsier still. He had slept the previous night, but his sleep hadn't been restful. Now he dozed off with his hands full of breadcrumbs. The ducks finished with what was on the grass, and then drew closer to him, quacking in low, ruminative tones. The clock in the town square bonged the hour of 2 at 12:20, causing people downtown to shake their heads and ask each other what the world was coming to. Bobby's doze deepened by degrees, and when a shadow fell over him, he didn't see it or sense it. "Hey, kid." The voice was quiet and intense. Bobby sat up with a gasp and a jerk, his hands opening and spilling out the remaining bread. Those snakes began to crawl around in his belly again. It wasn't Willie Shearman or Richie O'Meara or Harry Doolin. Even coming out of a doze, he knew that. But Bobby almost wished it had been one of them. Even all three, a beating wasn't the worst thing that could happen to you. No, not the worst. Cripes, why did he have to go and fall asleep?
Kid!
The ducks were stepping on Bobby's feet, squabbling over the unexpected windfall. Their wings were fluttering against his ankles and his shins. But the feeling was far away, far away. He could see the shadow of a man's head on the grass ahead of him. The man was standing behind him.
Kid!
Slowly and creakily, Bobby turned. The man's coat would be yellow, and somewhere on it would be an eye, a staring red eye.
but the man who stood there was wearing a tan summer suit. The jacket pooched out by a little stomach that was starting to grow into a big stomach, and Bobby knew at once it wasn't one of them, after all. There was no itching behind his eyes, no black threads across his field of vision, but the major thing was that this wasn't some creature just pretending to be a person. It was a person.
What? Bobby asked, his voice low and muzzy. He still couldn't believe he'd gone to sleep like that, blanked out like that. What do you want?
I'll give you $2 to let me blow you, the man in the tan suit said. He reached into the pocket of his jacket and brought out his wallet. We can go behind the tree over there. No one will see us, and you'll like it.
No, Bobby said, getting up. He wasn't completely sure what the man in the tan suit was talking about, but he had a pretty good idea.
The ducks scattered backward, but the bread was too tempting to resist, and they returned, pecking and dancing around Bobby's sneakers. I have to go home now, my mother.
The man came closer, still holding out his wallet. It was as if he decided to give the whole thing to Bobby, never mind the $2 lousy.
You don't have to do it to me. I'll just do it to you. Come on, what do you say? I'll make it $3.
The man's voice was trembling now, jigging and jagging up and down the scale, at one moment seeming to laugh, at the next almost to weep.
You can go to the movies for a month on $3.
No, really,
you'll like it. All my boys like it.
He reached out for Bobby, and suddenly Bobby thought of Ted, taking hold of his shoulders. Ted, putting his hands behind his neck. Ted, pulling him closer until they were almost close enough to kiss. That wasn't like this, and yet it was. Somehow it was.
Without thinking about what he was doing, Bobby bent and grabbed one of the ducks. He lifted it in a surprised squawking flurry of beak and wings and paddling feet, had just a glimpse of one black bead of an eye, and then threw it at the man in the tan suit. The man yelled and put his hands up to shield his face, dropping his wallet.
Bobby ran. He was passing through the square headed back home when he saw a poster on a telephone pole outside the candy store. He walked over to it and read it with silent horror. He couldn't remember his dream of the night before, but something like this had been in it. He was positive.
Have you seen Broad again? He is an old mongrel, but we love him. Broad again has white fur and blue eyes. He is friendly. We'll eat scraps from your hand. We will pay a very large reward. If you have seen Broad again, call Housatonic 58337 or bring Broad again to 745 Highgate Avenue, home of the Sagamore family.
This isn't a good day, Bobby thought, watching his hand reach out and pull the poster off the telephone pole. Beyond it, hanging from a bulb on the marquee of the Harwich Theater, he saw a dangling blue kite tail. This isn't a good day at all. I never should have gone out of the apartment. In fact, I should have stayed in bed. Housatonic 58337, just like on the poster about Phil the Welsh Corgi. Except that there was a Housatonic exchange in Harwich. Bobby never heard of it. Some of the numbers were on the Harwich exchange. Others were Commonwealth. But Housatonic? No. Not here. Not in Bridgeport either. He crumpled the poster up and threw it in the Keep Our Town Clean and Green basket on the corner. But on the other side of the street he found another just like it. Farther along he found a third, pasted to a corner mailbox. He tore these down as well. The low men were either closing in or desperate, maybe both. Ted couldn't go out at all today. Bobby would have to tell him that, and he'd have to be ready to run. He'd tell him that, too. Bobby cut through the park, almost running himself in his hurry to get home, and he barely heard the small, gasping cry which came from his left as he passed the baseball fields. Bobby! He stopped and looked toward the grove of trees where Carol had taken him the day before when he started to bawl. And when the gasping cry came again, he realized it was her. Bobby, if it's you, please help me. He turned off the cement path and ducked into the copse of trees. What he saw there made him drop his baseball glove on the ground. It was an Alvin Dark model, that glove, and later it was gone. Someone came along and just kifed it, he supposed, and so what?
As that day wore on, his lousy baseball glove was the very least of his concerns. Carol sat beneath the same elm tree where she had comforted him. Her knees were drawn up to her chest. Her face was ashy gray. Black shock circles ringed her eyes, giving her a raccoony look. A thread of blood trickled from one of her nostrils. Her left arm lay across her midriff, pulling her shirt tight against the beginning nubs of what would be breasts in another year or two. She held the elbow of that arm cupped in her right hand. She was wearing shorts and a smock-type blouse with long sleeves, the kind of thing you just slipped on over your head. Later, Bobby would lay much of the blame for what happened on that stupid shirt of hers. She must have worn it to protect against sunburn. It was the only reason he could think of to wear long sleeves on such a murderously hot day. Had she picked it out herself, or had Mrs. Gerber forced her into it? And did it matter? Yes, Bobby would think when there was time to think it mattered. You're damned right it mattered. But for now, the blouse with its long sleeves was peripheral. The only thing he noticed in that first instant was Carol's upper left arm. It seemed to have not one shoulder, but two.
Bobby,
she said, looking at him with shining, dazed eyes. They hurt me. She was in shock, of course. He was in shock himself by then, running on instinct. He tried to pick her up, and she screamed in pain. Dear God, what a sound.
I'll run and get help, he said, lowering her back. You just sit there and try not to move.
She was shaking her head, carefully so as not to joggle her arm. Her blue eyes were nearly black with pain and terror.
No, Bobby, no, don't leave me here. What if they come back? What if they come back and hurt me worse?
Parts of what happened on that long, hot Thursday were lost to him, lost in the shockwave. But that part always stood clear, Carol looking up at him and saying, what if they come back and hurt me worse?
But, Carol, I can walk. If you help me, I can walk.
Bobby put a tentative arm around her waist, hoping she wouldn't scream again. That had been bad. Carol got slowly to her feet, using the trunk of the tree to support her back. Her left arm moved a little as she rose. That grotesque double shoulder bulged and flexed. She moaned, but didn't scream, thank God.
You better stop, Bobby said.
No, I want to get out of here. Help me, oh God, it hurts. Once she was all the way up, it seemed a little better. They made their way out of the grove with the slow, side-by-side solemnity of a couple about to be married. Beyond the shade of the trees, the day seemed even hotter than before and blindingly bright. Bobby looked around and saw no one. Somewhere deeper in the park, a bunch of little kids, probably sparrows or robins from Sterling House, were singing a song, but the area around the baseball field was utterly deserted. No kids, no mothers wheeling baby carriages, no sign of Officer Raymer, the local cop who would sometimes buy you an ice cream or a bag of peanuts if he was in a good mood. Everyone was inside, hiding from the heat. Still moving slowly, Bobby with his arm around Carol's waist, they walked along the path which came out on the corner of Commonwealth and Broad. Broad Street Hill was as deserted as the park. The paving shimmered like the air over an incinerator. There wasn't a single pedestrian or moving car in sight. They stepped onto the sidewalk, and Bobby was about to ask if she could make it across the street when Carol said in a high, whispery voice, "Oh, Bobby, I'm fainting." He looked at her in alarm and saw her eyes roll up to glistening whites. She swayed back and forth like a tree which has been cut almost all the way through. Bobby bent, moving without thinking, catching her around the thighs and the back as her knees unlocked. He had been standing to her right and was able to do this without hurting her left arm any more than it already had been hurt. Also, even in her faint, Carol kept her right hand cupped over her left elbow, holding the arm almost steady. Carol Gerber was Bobby's height, perhaps even a little taller, and close to his weight. He should have been incapable of even staggering up Broad Street with her in his arms, but people in shock are capable of amazing bursts of strength. Bobby carried her, and not at a stagger. Under that burning June sun, he ran.
No one stopped him. No one asked him what was wrong with the little girl. No one offered to help. He could hear cars on Asher Avenue, but this part of the world seemed eerily like Midwich, where everyone had gone to sleep at once. Taking Carol to her mother never crossed his mind. The Gerber apartment was farther up the hill, but that wasn't the reason. Ted was all Bobby could think of. He had to take her to Ted. Ted would know what to do. His preternatural strength began to give out as he climbed the steps to the front porch of his building. He staggered, and Carol's grotesque double shoulder bumped against the railing. She stiffened in his arms and cried out, her half-lidded eyes opening wide. "Almost there," he told her in a panting whisper that didn't sound much like his own voice. "Almost there. I'm sorry I bumped you, but we're almost." The door opened, and Ted came out. He was wearing gray suit pants and a strap-style undershirt. Suspenders hung down to his knees in swinging loops. He looked surprised and concerned, but not frightened. Bobby managed the last porch step and then swayed backward. For one terrible moment, he thought he was going to go crashing down, maybe splitting his skull on the cement walk. Then Ted grabbed him and steadied him. "Give her to me," he said. "Get over on her other side first," Bobby panted. His arms were twanging like guitar strings, and his shoulders seemed to be on fire. "That's the bad side." Ted came around and stood next to Bobby. Carol was looking up at them, her sandy blonde hair hanging down over Bobby's wrist. "They hurt me," she whispered to Ted. "Willie, I asked him to make them stop, but he wouldn't." "Don't talk," Ted said. "You're going to be all right." He took her from Bobby as gently as he could, but they couldn't help joggling her left arm a little. The double shoulder moved under the white smock. Carol moaned, then began to cry. Fresh blood trickled from her right nostril, one brilliant red drop against her skin. Bobby had a momentary flash from his dream of the night before. The eye. The red eye. "Hold the door for me, Bobby." Bobby held it wide. Ted carried Carol through the foyer and into the Garfield apartment. At that same moment, Liz Garfield was descending the iron steps leading from the Harwich stop of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad to Main Street, where there was a taxi stand. She moved with the slow deliberation of a chronic invalid. A suitcase dangled from each hand. Mr. Burton, proprietor of the newsstand kiosk, happened to be standing in his doorway and having a smoke. He watched Liz reach the bottom of the steps, turn back the veil of her little hat, and gingerly dab at her face with a bit of handkerchief. She winced at each touch. She was wearing makeup a lot, but the makeup didn't help. The makeup only drew attention to what had happened to her. The veil was better, even though it only covered the upper part of her face, and now she lowered it again. She approached the first of three idling taxis, and the driver got out to help her with her bags. Burton wondered who had given her the business. He hoped whoever it had been was currently getting his head massaged by big cops with hard hickories. A person who would do something like that to a woman deserved no better. A person who would do something like that to a woman had no business running around loose. That was Burton's opinion. Bobby thought Ted would put Carol on the couch, but he didn't. There was one straight-backed chair in the living room, and that was where he sat, holding her on his lap. He held her the way the Grant's department store Santa Claus held the little kids who came up to him as he sat on his throne. "Where else are you hurt besides the shoulder?"
"They hit me in the stomach and on my side."
"Which side?"
"The right one."
Ted gently pulled her blouse up on that side.
Bobby hissed in air over his lower lip when he saw the bruise which lay diagonally across her rib cage. He recognized the baseball bat shape of it at once. He knew whose bat it had been. Harry Doolin's, the pimply galoot who saw himself as Robin Hood in whatever stunted landscape passed for his imagination.
He and Richie O'Meara and Willie Sherman had come up upon her in the park, and Harry had worked her over with his ball bat while Richie and Willie held her, all three of them laughing and calling her the Gerber baby. Maybe it had started as a joke and gotten out of hand. Wasn't that pretty much what had happened in Lord of the Flies? Things had just gotten a little out of hand. Ted touched Carol's waist, his bunchy fingers spread and then slowly slid up her side. He did this with his head cocked, as if he were listening rather than touching. Maybe he was. Carol gasped when he reached the bruise. Hurt? Ted asked. A little, not as bad as my shoulder. They broke my arm, didn't they? No, I don't think so, Ted replied. I heard it pop. So did they. That's when they ran.
I'm sure you did hear it. Yes, indeed.
Tears were running down her cheeks and her face was still ashy, but Carol seemed calmer now. Ted held her blouse up against her armpit and looked at the bruise. He knows what that shape is just as well as I do, Bobby thought.
How many were there, Carol?
Three, Bobby thought. Three.
Three boys?
She nodded.
Three boys against one little girl? They must have been afraid of you. They must have thought you were a lion. Are you a lion, Carol?
I wish I was, Carol said. She tried to smile. I wish I could have roared and made them go away. They hurt me.
I know they did. I know.
His hand slid down her side and cupped the bat bruise on her ribcage.
Breathe in.
The bruise swelled against Ted's hand. Bobby could see its purple shape between his nicotine-stained fingers.
Does that hurt?
She shook her head.
Not to breathe?
No.
And not when your ribs go against my hand?
No, only sore. What hurts is... She glanced quickly at the terrible shape of her double shoulder, then away.
I know. Poor Carol. Poor darling. We'll get to that.
Where else did they hit you? In the stomach, you said?
Yes.
Ted pulled her blouse up in front. There was another bruise, but this one didn't look so deep or so angry. He prodded gently with his fingers, first above her belly button and then below it. She said there was no pain like in her shoulder, that her belly was only sore like her ribs were sore.
They didn't hit you in your back?
No.
In your head or your neck?
Uh-uh. Just my side and my stomach, and then they hit me in the shoulder, and there was that pop, and they heard it, and they ran. I used to think Willie Sherman was nice.
She gave Ted a woeful look.
Turn your head for me, Carol. Good. Now the other way. It doesn't hurt when you turn it?
No. And you're sure they never hit your head?
No, I mean, yes, I'm sure.
Lucky girl.
Bobby wondered how in the hell Ted could think Carol was lucky. Her left arm didn't look just broken to him, it looked half torn off. He suddenly thought of a roast chicken Sunday dinner and the sound the drumstick made when you pulled it loose. His stomach knotted. For a moment, he thought he was going to vomit up his breakfast and the day-old bread, which had been his only lunch. No, he told himself. Not now. You can't. Ted's got enough problems without adding you to the list.
Bobby?
Ted's voice was clear and sharp. He sounded like a guy with more solutions than problems, and what a relief that was.
Are you all right?
Yeah.
And he thought it was true.
His stomach was starting to settle.
Good.
You did well to get her up here. Can you do well a little longer?
Yeah. I need a pair of scissors. Can you find one?
Bobby went into his mother's bedroom, opened the top drawer of her dresser, and got out her wicker sewing basket. Inside was a medium-sized pair of shears. He hurried back into the living room with them and showed them to Ted. Are these all right?
Fine, he said, taking them.
Then to Carol. I'm going to spoil your blouse, Carol. I'm sorry, but I have to look at your shoulder now, and I don't want to hurt you any more than I can help. It's okay, she said, and again tried to smile. Bobby was a little in awe of her bravery. If his shoulder had looked like that, he probably would have been blatting like a sheep caught in a barbed wire fence.
You can wear one of Bobby's shirts, huh? Can't you, Bobby?
Sure, I don't mind a few cooties.
Funny, Carol said.
Working carefully, Ted cut the smock up the back and then up the front. With that, then, he pulled the two pieces off like the shell of an egg. He was very careful on the left side, but Carol uttered a hoarse scream when Ted's fingers brushed her shoulder. Bobby jumped, and his heart, which had been slowing down, began to race again.
I'm sorry, Ted murmured. Oh, my. Look at this.
Carol's shoulder was ugly, but not as bad as Bobby had feared. Perhaps few things were, once you were looking right at them. The second shoulder was higher than the normal one, and the skin there was stretched so tight that Bobby didn't understand why it didn't just split open. It had gone a peculiar lilac color as well. How bad is it? Carol asked. She was looking in the other direction across the room. Her small face had the pinched, starved look of a UNICEF child. So far as Bobby knew, she never looked at her hurt shoulder after that single quick peek. I'll be in a cast all summer, won't I?
I don't think you're going to be in a cast at all.
Carol looked up into Ted's face wonderingly.
It's not broken, child, only dislocated. Someone hit you on the shoulder.
Harry Doolin.
And hard enough to knock the top of the bone in your upper left arm out of its socket. I can put it back in, I think. Can you stand one or two moments of quite bad pain if you know things may be all right again afterward?
Yes, she said at once. Fix it, Mr. Brodigan, please fix it.
Bobby looked at him a little doubtfully. Can you really do that?
Yes, give me your belt.
Huh?
Your belt, give it to me.
Bobby slipped his belt, a fairly new one he'd gotten for Christmas, out of its loops and handed it to Ted, who took it without ever shifting his eyes from Carol's.
What's your last name, honey?
Gerber. They call me the Gerber baby, but I'm not a baby.
I'm sure you're not, and this is where you prove it. He got up, settled her in the chair, then knelt before her like a guy in some old movie getting ready to propose. He folded Bobby's belt over twice in his big hands, then poked it at her good hand until she let go of her elbow and closed her fingers over the loops.
Good. Now, put it in your mouth.
Put Bobby's belt in my mouth?
Ted's gaze never left her. He began stroking her unhurt arm from the elbow to the wrist. His fingers trailed down her forearm, stopped, rose, and went back to her elbow, trailed down her forearm again. It's like he's hypnotizing her, Bobby thought, but there was really no like about it. Ted was hypnotizing her. His pupils had begun to do that weird thing again, growing and shrinking, growing and shrinking, growing and shrinking. Their movement and the movement of his fingers were exactly in rhythm. Carol stared into his face, her lips parted.
Ted, your eyes.
Yes, yes. He sounded impatient, not very interested in what his eyes were doing.
Pain rises, Carol. Did you know that?
No.
Her eyes on his fingers on her arm, going down and rising, going down and rising, his pupils like a slow heartbeat. Bobby could see Carol relaxing in the chair. She was still holding the belt, and when Ted stopped his finger stroking long enough to touch the back of her hand, she lifted it toward her face with no protest.
Oh, yes, he said. Pain rises from its source to the brain. When I put your shoulder back in its socket, there will be a lot of pain. But you'll catch most of it in your mouth as it rises toward your brain. You will bite it with your teeth and hold it against Bobby's belt so that only a little of it can get into your head, which is where things hurt the most. Do you understand me, Carol?
Yes. Her voice had grown distant. She looked very small sitting there in the straight-backed chair wearing only her shorts and her sneakers. The pupils of Ted's eyes, Bobby noticed, had grown steady again.
Put the belt in your mouth. She put it between her lips. Bite when it hurts.
When it hurts.
Catch the pain. I'll catch it. Ted gave a final stroke of his big forefinger from her elbow to her wrist and looked at Bobby. Wish me luck, he said.
Luck, Bobby replied fervently. Distant, dreaming.
Carol Gerber said, Bobby threw a duck at a man.
Did he?
Ted asked. Very, very gently, he closed his left hand around Carol's left wrist. Bobby thought the man was a low man.
Ted glanced at Bobby.
Not that kind of low man, Bobby said. Just, oh, never mind.
All the same, Ted said, they are very close. The town clock, the town whistle.
I heard, Bobby said grimly.
I'm not going to wait until your mother comes back tonight. I don't dare. I'll spend the day in a movie or a park or somewhere else. If all else fails, there are flop houses in Bridgeport.
Carol, are you ready?
Ready.
When the pain rises, what will you do?
Catch it. Bite it into Bobby's belt.
Good girl. 10 seconds, and you are going to feel a lot better.
Ted drew in a deep breath. Then he reached out with his right hand until it hovered just above the lilac-colored bulge in Carol's shoulder.
Here comes the pain, darling. Be brave.
It wasn't 10 seconds, not even 5. To Bobby, it seemed to happen in an instant. The heel of Ted's right hand pressed directly against that knob rising out of Carol's stretched flesh. At the same time, he pulled sharply on her wrist. Carol's jaws flexed as she clamped down on Bobby's belt. Bobby heard a brief creaking sound like the one his neck sometimes made when it was stiff and he turned his head. And then the bulge in Carol's arm was gone.
Bingo! Ted cried. Looks good! Carol?
She opened her mouth. Bobby's belt fell out of it and onto her lap. Bobby saw a line of tiny points embedded in the leather she had bitten nearly all the way through. It doesn't hurt anymore, she said wonderingly. She ran her right hand up to where the skin was now turning a darker purple, touched the bruise, winced.
That'll be sore for a week or so, Ted warned her, and you mustn't throw or lift with that arm for at least 2 weeks. If you do, it may pop out again.
I'll be careful. Now Carol could look at her arm. She kept touching the bruise with light, testing fingers.
How much of the pain did you catch? Ted asked her, and although his face was still grave, Bobby thought he could hear a little smile in his voice.
Most of it, she said. I hardly hurt at all. As soon as these words were out, however, she slumped back in the chair. Her eyes were open but unfocused. Carol had fainted for the second time. Ted told Bobby to wet a cloth and bring it to him. Cold water, he said. Bring it out, but not too much. Bobby ran into the bathroom, got a face cloth from the shelf by the tub, and wet it in cold water. The bottom half of the bathroom window was frosted glass. But if he had looked out the top half, he would have seen his mother's taxi pulling up out front. Bobby didn't look. He was concentrating on his chore. He never thought of the green key fob either, although it was lying on the shelf right in front of his eyes. When Bobby came back into the living room, Ted was sitting in the straight-backed chair with Carol in his lap again. Bobby noticed how tanned her arms had already become compared to the rest of her skin, which was a pure, smooth white, except for where the bruises stood out. She looks like she's wearing nylon stockings on her arms, he thought, a little amused. Her eyes had begun to clear, and they tracked Bobby when he moved toward her, but Carol still didn't look exactly great. Her hair was mussed, her face was all sweaty, and there was that drying trickle of blood between her nostril and the corner of her mouth. Ted took the cloth and began to wipe her cheeks and forehead with it. Bobby knelt by the arm of the chair. Carol sat up a little, raising her face gratefully against the cool and the wet. Ted wiped away the blood under her nose, then put the face cloth aside on the end table. He brushed Carol's sweaty hair off her brow. When some of it flopped back, he moved his hand to brush it away again. Before he could, the door to the porch banged open. Footfalls crossed the foyer. The hand on Carol's damp forehead froze. Bobby's eyes met Ted's, and a single thought flowed between them. Strong telepathy, consisting of a single word, them. No, Carol said, not them. Bobby, it's your... The apartment door opened, and Liz stood there with her key in one hand and her hat, the one with the veil on it, in the other. Behind her and beyond the foyer, the door to all the hot outside world stood open. Side by side on the porch welcome mat were her two suitcases where the cab driver had put them. "Bobby, how many times have I told you to lock this damn—" She got that far, then stopped. In later years, Bobby would replay that moment again and again, seeing more and more of what his mother had seen when she came back from her disastrous trip to Providence. Her son, kneeling by the chair where the old man she had never liked or really trusted sat with the little girl in his lap. The little girl looked dazed. Her hair was in sweaty clumps. Her blouse had been torn off. It lay in pieces on the floor. And even with her own eyes puffed, mostly shut, Liz would have seen Carol's bruises, one on the shoulder, one on the ribs, one on the stomach. And Carol and Bobby and Ted Brodigan saw her. With that same amazed stop-time clarity, the two black eyes, Liz's right eye was really nothing but a glitter deep in a puffball of discolored flesh. The lower lip, which was swelled and split in two places and still wearing flecks of dried blood like old, ugly lipstick. The nose, which lay askew and had grown a misbegotten hook, making it almost into a caricature witch hazel nose. Silence. A moment's considering silence on a hot summer afternoon. Somewhere a car backfired. Somewhere a kid shouted, "Come on, you guys." And from behind them on Colony Street came the sound Bobby would identify most strongly with his childhood in general, and that Thursday in particular, Mrs. O'Hara's Bowser barking his way ever deeper into the 20th century. Roof, 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 roof. Roof. Jack got her, Bobby thought. Jack Merridew and his Nimrod friends.
Oh, jeez, what happened? He asked her, breaking the silence.
He didn't want to know. He had to know. He ran to her, starting to cry out of fright, but also out of grief. Her face, her poor face. She didn't look like his mom at all. She looked like some old woman who belonged not on Shady Broad Street, but down there where people drank wine out of bottles and paper sacks and had no last names.
What did he do? What did that bastard do to you?
She paid no attention, seemed not to hear him at all. She laid hold of him, though, laid hold of his shoulders, hard enough for him to feel her fingers sinking into his flesh, hard enough to hurt. She laid hold and then set him aside without a single look. Let her go, you filthy man, she said in a low and rusty voice. Let her go right now. Mrs. Garfield, please don't misunderstand. Ted lifted Carol off his lap, careful even now to keep his hand well away from her.